You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
I'm David Wessel. I'm director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy here at Brookings. Our mission is to improve the quality of fiscal and monetary policy and public understanding of it. Hopefully we will not be judged by performance, but it seemed to us that one of the most vexing questions that comes up with monetary policy is, did the Fed's very aggressive asset buying, the bond purchases known as quantitative easing, contribute substantially to the increase in inequality? And if so, how much? Now, this is a topic on which there are some very strong opinions. There have been some analysis, and our intent here is to build on that analysis, to think through to the extent to which it's true. If so, how did it work? And if not, why is it that so many people think that inequality did result from the Fed's quantitative easing? We have three papers to present this morning. All of them are already posted on our website, three different cuts at the issue. And our plan this morning is to have each of the papers presented. We have a discussant, then we'll take some questions for a few minutes after each paper. And then at the end of the morning, we'll end with a panel discussion that includes a few of the presenters, along with my colleague Don Cohn, formerly of the Federal Reserve, and Kevin Warsh, formerly of the Federal Reserve, now at Stanford. Now, it seemed to me as I was reading these papers, some of which are more technical and economic model-based, and some of which are not, that there are two really important things to keep in mind. The first is, if all that the Federal Reserve did was increase stock prices, then there really wouldn't be much to talk about. Obviously, stocks are more widely held by people at the top than people in the middle and the bottom, and if stock prices go up, they benefit more. But as Josh Bivens points out in the paper he'll deliver in a moment, house prices are a pretty important factor in all this, and for the middle class, house prices are a large part of their assets. So to the extent that house prices go up, it kind of muddies the story a little bit of just looking at what happened to stock prices. But the other thing that's important to keep in mind is one that economists do very well and few other people do, which is to keep in mind the counterfactual. What would have happened had the Fed not done quantitative easing? The compared to what question, which is by its nature hypothetical, is really important because you can't assume that something would have happened, or at least have to examine the alternatives. And that's one of the things we'll try and do here this morning. Before I introduce Josh, I just want to point out that Ben Bernanke isn't with us today. He's traveling in Asia, but he's interested in the issue and weighed in on his blog this morning. And no surprise, bottom line, he rejects the view that the Fed's monetary policies have hurt the poor and middle class at the and relative to the rich. And you can see that on his blog. We're joined this morning by webcam cameras from Brookings and C-SPAN, so this is live. So don't say anything you don't want the rest of the world to hear. And I'm going to start by introducing Josh Bivens, who's chief economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. He's going to look at the channels through which monetary policy works and discuss the distributional consequences of each, and then do that important compared to what question, what would have happened had the Fed not have done quantitative easing, and what would be the distributional consequences of that. After he presents, Susan Lund of the McKinsey Global Institute, which has done interesting work on this subject, will respond, and then the two of them will join me up here for a little discussion. We'll take your questions before we go to the next paper, which I'll describe when that time comes. So, Josh?
Good morning. First of all, thank you to the Hutchins Center for the invitation to participate in this conference, particularly David Wessel and Louise Shiner, who talked to me about the paper and undoubtedly made it a lot better than it would have been otherwise. I'm the Research and Policy Director at the Economic Policy Institute, and just if you don't know, I think it's pretty fair to say that EPI has been for years as exercised as anybody about the rise in inequality that has characterized the U.S. economy over the past generation. And besides being exercised about it, we also think the rise in inequality has pretty strong roots in intentional policy decisions. So when I was asked if I wanted to write something on the intersection between monetary policy and inequality, I was definitely intrigued. My priors going in were definitely that successful macroeconomic stabilization policy is strongly progressive, not just useful and important to do, but progressive, provides bigger benefits to the low and moderate income households. So I entered with the thought that the expansionary monetary policy during the Great Recession, should that really be different? Well, we know the monetary policy since the Great Recession began has been very different in how it's implemented and the tools that are used, so this was definitely worth looking into. And if my look adds anything to this debate, and who knows, it might not, it's basically what David talked about in his introduction. You really want to specify some baseline against which you were judging the effect of expansionary monetary policy and the asset purchases in general over the past 6 or 7 years. And so the two baselines I'm talking about, the first one, I'm going to compare it to a fiscal policy stimulus that yielded just equivalent impacts on economic output. And so that's one. And what would be the distributional consequences of switching from one to the other? The second baseline is going to be no change in other forms of macroeconomic stimulus at all. Just if the Fed had decided not to do the asset purchases beginning in 2009, just nothing else happened. And what would be the consequence of that? The first baseline, fiscal policy stimulus that yields an equivalent boost to economic activity, it's probably of more interest to academics. And this is a blogger, Nick Rowe. He writes at a place called Worthwhile Canadian Initiative. Really keen observer of monetary policy and the transmission mechanism, worth reading. And he frames the question like this. And basically, his what he thinks the right question is, if we use fiscal policy instead of monetary policy to remove a shortage of aggregate demand, would that switch from one to another have distributional consequences? And so that's basically what I'm going to look at. There's a couple problems right out of the gate, though. I mean, there's no such thing as a generic fiscal stimulus. You can do lots of different things to provide a fiscal boost to the economy. Just think about tax cuts, just one kind of possible fiscal stimulus. The distributional implications can be really different. We had the 2001 and 2003 tax cuts, which, you know, they were justified some on supply-side long-run growth grounds, but in real time, they were also justified a lot on sort of Keynesian aggregate demand management grounds. Those were not particularly progressive. The 2008 tax cut that was part of the Economic Stimulus Act, also signed by President George W. Bush, much more progressive. So just, you know, within tax cuts, it's really hard to characterize the distributional implications. Transfers, the way transfers are the nature of them in the U.S. economy, they tend to focus most of their benefits on the bottom, say, two-fifths of the income distribution. So increases in transfers as a way of doing fiscal stimulus are going to be pretty strongly progressive. And then a really important issue concerns the benefits of direct government spending and investment increases. Both in theoretical models and in the empirical research about the fiscal policy that is effective when the economy is stuck at the zero lower bound of interest rates, government spending, direct government spending comes in really strong, and so we really probably want to know what the distributional implications of that spending is. The Congressional Budget Office suggests allocating it in two ways. You can either sort of allocate the direct spending on a per capita basis, kind of a think of it as a lump sum spread across the entire population, or you can allocate it proportional to the existing distribution of income. Those yield two really different results, right? I mean, the second one is kind of by definition neutral if you're just going to allocate it proportionally to income. The first way is pretty progressive if it really is sort of a lump sum spending on a per capita basis. And then, of course, it's probably very different depending on what kind of spending we're talking about. The distributional implications of defense spending are probably really different than grants to provide bus service in urban areas or school construction in poorer school districts. So the punchline of all this is it's really hard to think of a generic fiscal policy against which to judge what the Federal Reserve has done since the Great Recession began. And so I decided to try to find a particular fiscal policy intervention that is about equal to the estimated impact of the LSAPs over the past 6 or 7 years on economic activity. And it turns out there's a decent one. It's basically the stimulus provisions that were part of the 2010 fiscal deal that sort of pushed back when the Bush tax cuts on the top 2% would be rolled back. And you can see, I would just sort of look at the two columns on the right, the GDP effect and the unemployment effect. Basically, the stimulus portions of the 2010 fiscal deal, which were basically a 2% payroll tax cut on the employee side, expanded unemployment insurance, and extension of the refundable tax credits that were part of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, they basically have almost the same effect, estimated effect on GDP as the impact of the LSAPs, and obviously the estimated impact of the asset purchases, there's a lot of variation there. It's not really tightly estimated. So this is rough orders of magnitude. You know, the first question might be, why did you compare it to the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act? That's the most high-profile case of fiscal policy stimulus over the past couple of years. And the answer is that the estimated impacts of ARRA were really quite large, quite a bit larger than the estimated impacts of the asset purchases. And I'm not really willing to say that the impact of the asset purchases are linear, that you can just sort of scale them up and say, let's say we've done two of those. That would equal ARRA. I don't think it probably works like that. And then also you might ask, why don't I include the actual pushing back of the high-end Bush tax cuts as stimulus in the 2010 fiscal deal? Because they're really, really small, their stimulus impact. I mean, the full range of tax cuts, if they had expired in 2010, might have been big, but that was never going to happen. Every single politician in town wanted to preserve everything except that it was affecting the 2% and below. So this is sort of the specific fiscal intervention that I'm going to compare to the LSAPs. And just the distribution of the 2010 fiscal deal, you can use basically the Congressional Budget Office data on household income to sort of get a sense of where that money went. and so that first column, the payroll tax cut, that tells you the share of total payroll taxes paid by different income groupings. So the bottom fifth of the income distribution pays about 5.6% of all payroll taxes. The sort of 96th to 99th percent pays 11% of all payroll taxes. And then you can compare that to the column all the way at the left. That's the overall income. That's their share in overall income. So a payroll tax cut is mildly progressive. The EUC extension, the unemployment insurance extension, the way that column is measuring the share of all non-Social Security cash transfers that go to different parts of the income distribution. And so I'm going to say that that's a pretty good proxy probably for where the unemployment insurance extensions went. And you can see those are quite strongly progressive, definitely concentrated in the middle, say, three-fifths of the income distribution. And then the refundable tax credits that were part of the deal, they're really strongly important for the bottom two-fifths. And basically I just allocated... And those are the portions of the income distribution that actually have negative federal income tax rates in the CBO data. And so that's where I'm allocating those. And so the combined impact of the sort of the fiscal provisions of the 2010 fiscal deal, they're pretty progressive, particularly the refundable credits and the EUC extension, the payroll tax a little less. And so now we can get to what did the large-scale asset purchases do to inequality? And the concern is that LSAPs are going to boost asset prices and that income generated by asset holding is really concentrated at the top. And that second point, that it's really concentrated at the top, is true. I mean, this is just a measure of share of total capital incomes claimed by various income percentiles. And you can see the top 1% is that blue wedge at the bottom. And so in 1979, the top 1% of households claimed about 38% of income generated by asset holding. By 2007, they were claiming 57% of income generated by assets. The bottom 90% has seen their share shrink. And so this is the root of the concern. But I actually, when I sort of digging into this and looking at sort of attempts to measure the actual impact of the LSAPs, I think that the distributional effects of those asset purchases are smaller than are often characterized in the popular press. Like some people have even called them, you know, the Fed doing a reverse Robin Hood. That strikes me as pretty strong. And I think there's three reasons why these effects are probably smaller than advertised. You know, timing, the fact that they're not that different from conventional monetary policy stimulus, except maybe a little less effective. And then the impact of housing, as David talked about before. On the timing issue, basically, the asset purchases are going to boost prices now, but at some point in the future, they will probably, almost surely, be unwound. And so that's going to put downward pressure on prices. If you held like a index fund of the stock market and you just held it over a long period of time, you would see your fund go up and then come down in terms of the marginal impact of LSAPs on that. You know, stocks are always incredibly concentrated. So basically, when you push up stock prices, you're helping today's stock owners, maybe at the expense of tomorrow's. But tomorrow's stock owners are not poor people, and they're not even middle-class people. They're pretty rich people as well. On the second point, it's really not that different what the LSAPs are doing than conventional monetary stimulus. I mean, conventional monetary policy pulls down short-term interest rates, and then you hope through arbitrage that the long-term rates that matter for consumption and investment decisions sort of fall in sympathy. And that's how it's supposed to work. LSAPs sort of go past that intermediating link because the short-term rates are already buried at zero and try to push down long-term rates directly. But the goal of both is to push down those long-term rates, and those long-term rates cannot go down if you're not pushing up asset prices at the same time. So it's really not that radically different a thing than conventional monetary policy. And in fact, some of the estimates in this say the impact of a given decline in long-term rates as a result of the LSAPs is actually less on stock prices than conventional monetary policy. And I think that's an interesting thing to examine, but that was replicated in a couple different studies. I mean, part of it may just be when you're measuring the effect of monetary policy at the zero lower bound, you're by definition measuring its impact in a pretty fragile and weak economy, but it's interesting to think about. And then the last one that's pretty important is, you know, housing is an asset, and its price can be affected by the LSAPs, and it's an asset that is held that's very important in the portfolio of the middle class. And so that thing I've highlighted right there, that's sort of the broad middle class. It's the middle 60% of the wealth distribution. And we can see that housing accounts for about 63% of their total wealth holdings. So if the impact on home prices stemming from the LSAPs is comparable at all to the estimated impact on stock prices, then you're really going to see, you know, a pretty neutral effect here. And in fact, what I found is most of the estimates or the implied estimates of the effect of LSAPs on housing prices are probably greater than its impact on stock prices. What I found on stock prices, sort of doing a broad scan of the literature, is maybe 5 to 10% increase in equity prices stemming from the LSAPs. And so sort of the broad distribution of housing wealth is another thing that makes these impacts smaller than you might think. And then I think the really important thing, that's sort of, you know, fiscal versus monetary, but then we have to think about the real world. And is it really true that if the Fed had decided to not do as much in the way of asset purchases, that fiscal policymakers would have said, well, of course, we shall jump into the gap and, you know, fill that hole in aggregate demand. And this is what has actually happened to government spending over this recession and recovery. And that line on the bottom, the 2009, is what's happened since the basically since the trough of the Great Recession. And you can see the red line, it slopes steeply up before the trough. And that's basically the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, that we actually did do some real fiscal stimulus to fight the recession. Starting at some point in about late 2010, early 2011, though, fiscal policy has been an outright drag on growth. And that's really historically kind of astonishing. If you look at the trajectory of government spending, real government spending in this recovery versus all others, fiscal policy has been a very large drag on growth. And so if it is true that output stabilization is progressive at all, then this baseline becomes really important. And if it's true that the LSAPs actually managed to keep unemployment lower than it would have been, then it's going to have really strongly progressive effects. And we find that low unemployment and that sort of macroeconomic stabilization, it really is progressive. And these are coefficients on a Phillips wage regression, which is basically the change in nominal wages on the left-hand side, lag consumer prices, lag productivity growth, some time period dummies, and then the unemployment rate on the right-hand side. And you can basically see that and we've got wages at the 10th percentile, the 50th percentile, and the 95th percentile. We've done them separately for men and women. And you can see that the wages of the 10th percentile and the 50th are much more sensitive to changes in the unemployment rate. The 95th percentile male wage, that's not statistically significant. That's why it's transparent. That's what the magnitude is, but it's not statistically significant. And so there is a strong equalizing effect of just output stabilization and low unemployment rates. And so that has to, you know, factor really largely. If you think the LSAPs helped stabilize the economy at all, this channel says that they were quite progressive. And just to end, what this says is that since the Great Recession, as the Fed has been pursuing expansionary monetary policy, I think it's pretty clear that's been a progressive intervention. I think when we're trying to choose between fiscal and monetary policy, I would have greatly preferred that fiscal policy carried a much heavier load in stabilization, but not necessarily because of its distributional implications. I just think the research says it's much more reliable and effective at the zero lower bound. The distributional outcomes are sort of second order. And I think we should fact that lower unemployment rates, you know, have really strong distributional consequences, it does mean we can look at sort of the history of Federal Reserve actions and what is going to happen over the next couple of years. That should affect us strongly. What this says to me is if we go into contractionary monetary policy too soon in the coming years, that actually will have some regressive implications. But what has happened over the past 6 or 7 years, I think the Fed policy has been pretty strongly progressive. And I am out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, David, for inviting me today. Good to see all of you here. First, I want to congratulate Josh on what is a very accessible and interesting paper on the impact of quantitative easing and LSAPs in particular on inequality. He takes us through a lot of the theory and the empirical evidence in a very accessible way and presents two very interesting counterfactuals, which is what would have happened if we had fiscal policy and what would have happened had the Fed done nothing. So overall, I find his arguments and argumentation in the paper very interesting, helpful for anyone to read. So I would congratulate Josh. I want to expand on his overall contention that, in fact, quantitative easing and the unconventional monetary policies of the last several years have not noticeably or significantly worsened inequality in terms of either wealth inequality or income inequality. Like Josh, I want to begin with the strong caveat that no one's disputing the fact that we've seen increases in both income and wealth inequality in the United States and in other countries, not only since 2007, but predating that as a long-term trend. And it's a concerning trend to an economist in terms of aggregate consumption, particularly for an economy like the United States, where 70% of GDP growth comes from consumer spending. And so the stagnant wages and incomes of a large segment of the population is indeed a concern. That said, there, I would agree very much with Josh, though, that there's very little evidence that the Federal Reserve's monetary policies have contributed significantly to this. There's been, and I'll walk through three reasons why this is so. First, there's been most of the attention has been paid to the impact of low interest rates and QE on asset prices. We did some work in a report a year and a half ago looking at this question and found, in fact, for equity prices, there's very little evidence that ultra-low interest rates have been responsible for the run-up in the U.S. stock market. First point is that many people tend to forget, although I'm not one of them looking at my personal financial statements, that at the end of 2008, U.S. equities lost 35% of their value. Global equities lost 37%. So the increases we've seen in the stock market, first of all, let's just put it in context. We're climbing out of a very deep hole. Secondly, you need to look at the theory of through what mechanism should low interest rates boost equity prices? Well, the most direct mechanism would be through a dividend pricing model. So we discount future cash flows, and the lower the interest rate, the lower the discount rate, and so that should boost any valuation of the net present value of future corporate income streams. So you think, all right, there's a very direct mechanism. However, both empirically and theoretically, there are some problems with this argumentation. First is that if you're a rational expectations investor, you should realize that quantitative easing and ultra-low interest rates are a temporary policy. And so you should not be valuing corporate prospects 10 years out based on whatever the current short-term or long-term rates are today. Secondly, sophisticated investors should be using an overall cost of equity, which includes not only the risk-free rate, which would be the interest rate, but also an equity market premium. And we've done modeling at McKinsey estimating what is the cost of equity, and we find that it is actually a very stable figure over many decades, ranging between 7 and 8% for U.S. equities, for instance. And this holds true since the recession. So even if investors believe the risk-free rate has gone down, they're apparently increasing the equity market risk premium, likely with the expectation that, in fact, that rates will increase. So theoretically, there's no real evidence there. The other argumentation is that, well, there's a substitution effect. You can't earn anything in bond funds, and so we switch to equity funds. When you look at actual investor behavior, again, there's very little evidence that either retail investors or certainly not professional money managers and institutional investors, in fact, see equities as an alternative asset class to bond fixed income funds. So overall, we conclude that that QE has boosted U.S. equity prices by maybe 5% at most compared to where they would have been. So then the question is, well, why have they increased? Well, corporate profits are at all-time historic highs. Companies are sitting on over $1 trillion of cash. So there are good fundamental reasons to believe that equity prices have gone up. When you look at a one-year forward-looking price-earnings ratio, you see that U.S. equities today are valued only very slightly over what a long-term average would have put them at. So to the extent that the wealthy do hold equities, it's true, they may have gotten some slight boost to the value of their wealth holding. The more important impact of ultra-low interest rates has been on housing prices. And there it's a much more direct channel because people buy housing with mortgages, and so as the cost of mortgages goes down, it should have supported housing prices, which, again, let's be clear, they have fallen dramatically, fell 30% or more across the U.S. on average. But the evidence is that they would have fallen even more and been even slower to recover without low interest rates. It's a more direct effect in economies where mortgages are variable rate, like the United Kingdom. The Bank of England has said that low interest rates may have supported UK housing prices by 15 to 20%. In the US, it's a somewhat less direct effect because most people have a fixed rate mortgage. So you needed a good credit score to be able to refinance to actually take advantage of these low interest rates. But as Josh's paper points out, to the extent we believe that housing prices have been supported, that would affect the broad middle class and not the wealthy, where for the top 10% of the income distribution, housing represents only 10% of their wealth portfolio, compared to the broad middle class, where it is the main financial asset. Now, the more direct impact of quantitative easing on household financial well-being that we look at in our report is on interest earnings and interest payments. So here it's a very direct effect, and we don't even need to go to theory. So on one hand, anyone with debt has a lower debt service ratio. And for U.S. households overall, you see that today's debt service ratio, which includes the cost of interest payments as well as principal payments, is now at a level last seen in the early 1990s, 20 years ago. This reflects both a reduction in mortgage debt through the process of deleveraging, but also the very low interest rate. So that's been a huge help for households with debt. Now, offsetting that, of course, is anyone with deposits in banks, in certificates of deposits, or in fixed income funds has seen very low returns on those types of savings. So we look at a figure called that we call the net interest earnings of American households, which nets out the lower debt service payments from the lower income earned on cash deposits and fixed income. And what you see is that there is a clear effect across the age distribution. So basically, households headed by people under age 54 have benefited because they tend to have more debt. And it's almost a linear effect. So households under age 35 on average have benefited by $1,500 per year. It's almost 3% of their disposable income. The group 35 to 44 is benefiting by about $1,700 per annum, 2% of their income. Then when you go to the other end of the age spectrum, households over 75 who tend not to have debt are losing $2,700 per year through lower interest earnings. Households between 65 and 75 are losing $1,900 per year, about 2% of their income. So there has been a generational impact for sure. Again, overall, though, hard to see how this worsens inequality. So I want to end with an open-ended question meant to spark discussion. In the research we did, we looked at the impact of ultra-low interest rates compared to what they had been. But in my mind, there's a very important question: to what extent are ultra-low interest rates even the product of monetary policy? When you look back over history, since the early 80s, you've seen both nominal and real interest rates fall quite dramatically. When you look across advanced economies, the real ex-post rate on 10-year government bonds averaged 8% in 1985. It's down to less than 1% today. The nominal rate on 10-year bonds fell from 14% in 1985 to 2% on average today. So what explains this? Well, as an economist, we learned that interest rates are the product of the supply and demand for funds. And Ben Bernanke, who's not with us, pointed out long before the recession that on one hand, we have the rise of surplus savings in many economies of the world, running large export surpluses and also commodity exporters. But at the same time, we've seen a real dearth of demand. So when you look at the gross investment rate of the U.S. and other advanced economies since since the early 80s, you see this secular decline in the amount invested in physical capital. Now, part of this reflects a shift to a knowledge economy and intangible capital. Part of it reflects the fact that capital goods cost less. They've had tremendous economies of scale, and their cost has come down. But overall, we're living in a world in which companies don't see investment opportunities. You read about share buybacks every other day in the press. Many companies have now decided to start to return some of that cash to shareholders simply because they don't see where productive investment is coming from. And so if we are living in a world of secular stagnation and one in which there are too few productive investment opportunities, then I think there's a real question about, even with large-scale asset purchases have ended on net, when we're going to see interest rates rise. And the phenomenon of very low interest rates may well persist for years to come and may be outside of the control of the Federal Reserve or other central banks. And I'm out of time.
This is what happens when you don't read the directions. Well, thank you both for both clear and succinct statements. I'm going to keep this session short of the questions so we can get to the rest of the papers. But Josh, let me ask you. So there are two things that just intuitively in my gut I wonder about. And one is, it seems to me there's a bit of a tension here. On one hand, you say all this monetary policy did a great job at restoring, getting us closer to full employment. So that's a plus. And then you say, but it didn't really have much impact on the stock market, so it doesn't have as bad effects on distribution as some people think. Well, aren't those two ideas at odds with each other? If the quantitative easing packs such a big punch that we think it helped get the economy stronger, how can we say it had such a small effect on stock prices?
Yeah. So I wouldn't say it packed that big a punch. I mean, I definitely think the direction of the LSAPs on economic activity and unemployment were in the right direction. It boosted economic activity. It lowered unemployment. I don't know that it was an enormous punch. Like the slide I had up there, I think it said basically a 2% of GDP peak effect, which happened sometime in the past year or so. So that to me is consistent without enormous impacts on the stock market. I guess my bigger point is that any positive impact in lowering unemployment has such strong progressive distributional consequences that even if the Fed's actions didn't have enormous impacts on unemployment, any impact on unemployment is so strongly progressive that that channel works really well if you're concerned about equity.
Susan, can you talk a little bit about the impact of very low interest rates and government bond purchases on governments? You wrote about this in the McKinsey report. And I think that goes to the really hard-to-answer counterfactual, which is, so did governments benefit from this, and shouldn't that have made it easier to do more aggressive fiscal policy, even though they didn't?
Yes. Thank you for remembering. One of our conclusions was governments are very clear, direct beneficiaries. When you look at the net interest payments, it's been much cheaper for governments to borrow. That's particularly true for the United States, where at the start of the recession, the average maturity on government bonds was in the neighborhood of 4.5 years, and they've now extended maturities a bit. But it is a direct savings to governments who can raise money more cheaply than they had. I would never suggest that the Federal Reserve made monetary policy decisions with that as even a remote consideration, but it did enable the U.S. government to have a healthier fiscal picture than it would have otherwise. And we can debate whether that should have been used on more aggressive fiscal stimulus early in the recession or even now.
Do you agree with Josh's view that so Josh made the point that there was no reason that the Federal Reserve could have expected, had it done less, that Congress would have done more? Do you agree with that? It's a political question.
I'll say I'm not a political scientist, but I am an economist, and empirically, we need only look back at the last 7 years to see that, you know, there has been gridlock in Washington.
You don't need to be an economist to see that. I think we can take a couple questions. Brendan has a mic, if there are any. Andy Levin over here. No, don't. Wait for the mic. We don't want to miss anything, Andy.
I really like your paper, Josh. It's a really important question. I just checked on kind of a couple websites. You know, the median real household income has dropped very substantially still since 2008. So, I mean, that to me, it's hard to believe that that's all kind of part of a structural trend. And so what you said at the beginning, that, you know, there are problems with intentional policy design, I think is the right answer here. And as you know, unemployment isn't a full measure of what's been happening in the labor market. So I think we should also be cautious about not exaggerating how much improvement there's been. So 2 points. First, you mentioned about, well, the stock market goes up, but then later when they kind of withdraw the LSAPs, it's going to come down. I'm not completely satisfied with that argument, partly because I think that, as Susan said, the stock market dropped a lot in the aftermath of the recession. And so part of the recovery that we see is a recovery back to something more, closer to a normal level. So it's not necessarily the case that ending the LSAPs or withdrawing, normalizing the balance sheet is going to actually cause a fall in the stock market. What we could think of is this was a policy that brought the stock market back up closer to its normal level quickly. And that was a policy decision. We could have made policy decisions to try to bring employment back quickly to its normal level. And that didn't really happen. Okay. The other point is that what you're comparing to fiscal alternatives, and for the reasons we've talked about, including the gridlock, I don't think that's the right comparison. So let me suggest two alternatives. One of them is forward guidance. That's the other tool that the FOMC has used and other central banks have used. It's an important tool. Mike Kiley has some very nice empirical work examining the differences between forward guidance and LSAPs. There are important differences in how they work. I think there's a strong argument that, and maybe Don can weigh in at some point, maybe over lunch, about the extent to which the Fed didn't really use forward guidance aggressively at all until around 2013, right? From 2009, 2010, 2011, you know, it was kind of this extended period language, which basically said we're only a few months or 9 months away from liftoff. And so in the same way that you're critical of fiscal policy, I think you could ask questions about, well, what would be a counterfactual where the Fed would have introduced much more aggressive forward guidance and then look at the distributional issues there.
So do you think there's a distributional difference between forward guidance and asset purchases?
That's what Mike Kiley's results suggest, and it has to do with the effects on the term premium versus the expected future short rates. So we could talk about that during a coffee break or something. Okay, but the other alternative, which was not considered in the United States but has been considered elsewhere, is to have more directed credit programs to try to provide credit to entrepreneurs, you know, and small businesses. And there are critical distributional issues here of the extent to which the easy monetary policy helps large corporations reduce their debt obligations. And really has not helped. We know this, right? The business startup rate has really not improved since 2008. So again, this would be something you could compare as a clean comparison, given it has to be monetary policy, that we're not going to count on the fiscal authorities jumping in. There's a couple other possibilities that could be considered, and what are the lessons for the future?
Yeah, so to be clear, it is in no way my contention that monetary policy sort of satisfactorily filled the shortfall in aggregate demand since the Great Recession. To me, the most reliable way we could have done that was with really aggressive fiscal policy, and we absolutely did not do that, and that's why I'm so critical of fiscal policymakers. To the degree that someone fumbled the ball in a mammoth way, to me, it's them. And to go back to your earlier question about how can we be sure that they wouldn't have somehow acted better if the Fed had not been so aggressive in the, you know, to my mind, that the Fed chairs communicated really strongly every time they spoke to Congress that fiscal policy is a drag on recovery. I think that's the phrase they have, and yet still there was no response from Congress. In terms of other counterfactuals and sort of other ways to do monetary policy that could have been better than what we did or amplified its reach, I totally agree with that. I mean, the recent paper by Simon Wren Lewis and Mark Blythe about maybe trying to figure out a way to give the Fed the ability to actually, you know, provide $500 to everybody's checking account, you know, maybe postal banking. They can't do it now.
for sure, but that would be a great thing for future recessions to think about. And then I would also add housing policy is a big part of this. I think we did miss a key transmission mechanism of lower interest rates because so many people who could have been able to refinance couldn't because their loan-to-value ratios were too high. And if we could have done some program to allow those people into the refinancing channel, that could have helped a lot. So
we'll get to that in a second.
Yeah, this is not to say, you know, the Fed did absolutely everything right. I think it's just to say that what they did do pushed in the right direction, even from sort of a distributional angle.
I would make two points. I think that the academic literature on forward guidance and its effectiveness is a little bit more subject to debate than you would suggest. At the end of the day, I think we all believe that should economic conditions change suddenly for the better or for the worse, the Federal Reserve and in any other central bank in the world would act very quickly, no matter what they said previously. But the second point on funding for small businesses, Europe has been the most aggressive with directed lending towards SMEs and trying to promote SME securitization to get credit going to small businesses. And I know this only because we're doing new research on this. But the results are quite astonishing. So if you take the EU as a whole and the U.S., they're roughly the same size economies in terms of GDP. U.S. SMEs outstanding, according to a study done out of London, have $3 trillion of outstanding credit, and in European ones, $1 trillion. So despite the attempt to get credit flowing to SMEs in Europe, that has not been a successful policy. So whatever the Fed has done right or not done right, funding for small businesses in the U.S. is dramatically
better. Well, but I think what Andy's saying is, I mean, it's good. Anytime you want to feel good about what happened in the United States, you just use Europe as a benchmark, right?
What could
we have done that would have made the outcomes different? Why don't we take one more question, and we'll get more to this. Bob Samuelson over there, and then we'll move to the second paper. We'll come back to these issues as the day goes on. Bob Samuelson.
Thanks. Bob Samuelson, Washington Post. Last week, Byron Wien, who was a well-known stock strategist, now works for Blackstone, put out a commentary in which he recounted the following arithmetic. Since the low point in 2009, stock market valuation has increased $13 trillion. Of that, he attributes $3 trillion, which is almost a quarter, to the Federal Reserve's QE policies. That's a major part of the increase. By contrast, your appraisals, both of your appraisals, is that the QE had at most a very modest effect on the increase in stock prices. Could you explain why you think, and I take Wien's arithmetic to be typical of Wall Street. There's sort of an obsession with what the Fed is doing and has done and will do. Could you try to explain why there is such a large gap between people who are in the markets and people who are watching people in the markets and trying to decide what they're doing and
okay,
why?
Okay, so pick Wall Street or economists, right?
Definitely go with the economists. Stock prices have risen, but they fell 35%, okay? So there's one factor. Second factor is, look, in our analysis of QE boosting stock prices by no more than 5%, we did not take into this broader-based economic growth effect. So that if the recession had been dramatically worse and corporate earnings would have therefore been dramatically worse, you know, how bad could it have been? That counterfactual is something we didn't measure. But for the reasons I explained, I think that corporate profitability is up. Low rates have helped companies very slightly through lower debt service payments, like they have helped households. But overall, we're living in a world where companies have done very, very well, particularly in the U.S., and that explains the outperformance. But I will take a look at those calculations and see where we come out so dramatically different.
Yeah, I haven't looked at his detailed calculations either. I haven't heard of this, so I would like to take a look. I would say I occasionally see sort of traders overestimating, in my view, the impact of sort of Federal Reserve decisions. And my guess it's because they live in such a short-term world. I mean, if you look at some of the empirical research on sort of LSAPs, it's sort of event study where they look at, you know, what happened when it's announced. And if you stop there, you might get a pretty dramatic effect. But, you know, then the price goes up when it's announced, and then it sort of decays over time. And so getting the impact of the LSAPs over the entire period of time, rather than that day that I remember when they announced it and stock prices jumped through the roof maybe, I feel like that's part of the difference between, you know, the trader view of the world, which is what happened, you know, day to day versus what has happened over sort of the entire time span.
But let's say that Byron Wien is right. And let's say that, I mean, after all, people who bet on the stock market tend to make more money at it than people who don't bet on the stock market. So if he was right, and if the effect on stock prices was a lot larger than in your as you discussed in the literature, given all the other things, including house prices, would that have made a big difference on the distribution question?
Yeah. I mean, the real horse race is between what it does to stock prices, which are very concentrated at the top, versus what it does to housing prices, which are broadly distributed. You know, if I'm wrong and there's a much larger impact on stock prices, then absolutely a lot of my conclusions would need to be modified.
Okay. Stay here for a minute. I'm just going to introduce the second panel so we can keep this going. The second paper we have, which follows really right very nicely after this, is by Martin Baraja, Eric Hurst, and Joseph Vavra of the University of Chicago, and Andreas Fuster of the New York Fed. Eric Hurst and Andreas are here with us today. And what they look at is, okay, it's great to say this was good for housing prices, but if you happen to have the misfortune of living in a community where all the housing prices were underwater, it wasn't going to lift your ass. You weren't going to have this luxury of refinancing, and it might not have helped. So their paper looks at inequality, but regionally rather than across classes. So why don't we go sit down, and we'll come back.
So our take is a little different than a lot of the other papers that are going on today, because we're not talking as much about people as we are about space. And we want to ask the question, where does monetary policy have more of a bite? In the places that we're doing relatively bad or in the places that we're doing relatively good? So in terms of the recent economic performance within the U.S. or within Europe, we know there's a large amount of heterogeneity across different types of places. So Las Vegas, Nevada versus Dallas, very different economic performance during the recession. Unemployment rate in Las Vegas got up to, you know, 13% or so. Dallas peaked about 7.5%, 8%. You know, the same type of scenario is going on within Europe, where Spain is hit much harder than it is in Germany. So when we think about monetary policy, we usually think of it as a pretty blunt tool. Okay, there's an interest rate, some sort of policy tool moving, and that kind of that because of we're talking about monetary unions, by definition, that interest rate is constant across the member union, the member states of the union. So what we want to think about, though, is the spatial component of monetary policy also has some sort of is the result of variation in collateral values potentially across space. The transmission of monetary policy to real activity. You've heard lots of different stories just in the first paper about how monetary policy affects real activity. It boosts stock prices. It boosts home prices. It kind of lowers the cost of credit, making firms borrow more, expanding investment, which might also cause them to hire more workers. To the extent that some of those transmission from a given monetary policy action to real activity is dependent upon local collateral values, and to the extent that local collateral values differ dramatically across space, monetary policy could then have differential impact across space. And I'm going to show you this through some data that the places where collateral values are most depressed sometimes see the least amount of response in terms of real activity to a given type of monetary policy. So what we do in the paper is two things. So I'm going to spend almost all my time today on just the first part, which is data. I'm just going to show you a bunch of data around the first quantitative easing, not because I believe quantitative easing is different than other types of monetary policy, but just because we could date it exactly. And I'm going to show you the response across different types of regions within the U.S. to some type of collateralized lending. In this case, I'm going to focus exclusively on refinancing. Again, our point is this applies to much broader types of lending and much broader types of monetary policy, but I'm going to use as a case study quantitative easing right around quantitative easing in the refinancing channel. And I'm going to show you a bunch of data about how refinancing was much stronger in parts of the economy, parts of the U.S. that were doing relatively stronger. And I'm going to show you that's going to actually translate into some aspects of spending, local real activity. Then the second part of the paper, which I'm not going to spend much time on today, is we try to write down a quantitative model that tries to put in the collateralized lending channel where there's two types of shocks in the model. One is a shock to, call it local income, local productivity, something that makes Las Vegas doing worse than Dallas. And then there's also going to be another type of shock, which is to collateral values. They might be causally correlated. The shock to productivity might cause house prices or collateral values in one place to change more than in another place. Or they might be arbitrarily uncorrelated. But it's the correlation between these two shocks that is going to determine the distributional effects of monetary policy and also the aggregate effect of a given monetary policy. So if we lower interest rates and the people in the places in the country that are wanting to borrow the most or having the most demand for credit aren't actually able to get that credit because collateral values are low, it can make monetary policy less effective in the aggregate than it would have otherwise. So this correlation between collateral shocks and real, productivity shocks or some other local driver of local income is going to be a key correlation that determines the distributional and the aggregate effects of monetary policy. So I'm not going to spend much time talking about that today, but that's going to be the key insight from the model we write down. So from the empirical part, we use a lot of data. Okay. So I'm going to try to measure again as a case study. Quantitative easing, the first one, and I'm going to look at refinancing behavior, and I'm going to use data from the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, which actually measures mortgage origination and mortgage application activity in real time. And we're using the micro data of this that is able to be accessed from inside the Federal Reserve that could date this by day. So you could get very fine type of temporal response in terms of when the monetary policy, when the mortgage activity takes place. We're also going to use data from Equifax that has their credit risk insight servicing data set, which kind of merges credit records into applications of mortgage origination activity. So then we could actually see large amounts of information about the borrowers and their loan-to-value ratios at the time of refinancing. So we're gonna, and then a bunch of other data sets as well to merge in, but those are our main two. So this first picture you should see here is the solid line is refinancing activity in the aggregate measured by the Mortgage Brokers Association. And the dashed line is just the 30-year mortgage rate rolling average over time changes. And you can see right at the moment of the every picture I show you for the rest of the day, that red line is going to be the announcement of the first quantitative easing program in November of 2008. And you can see at that moment, mortgage rates fell and refinancing activity increased within the U.S., okay, at that moment. Now, the second picture shows you the dark shaded line, how much of that mortgage activity was due to refinancing and how much of it was due to new originations. And you can see almost all of that activity that responded after the first quantitative easing was in mortgage refinancing. There wasn't a whole bunch of new home ownership buying at that time. It's just the refinancing of existing mortgages. And that's why we're going to focus on refinancing in the paper. Now, in the back of your mind, we should know what defines space. As we've been talking about, it's the value of collateral that might these locations are going to have at the moment that quantitative easing takes place. So what I'm showing you here is the loan-to-value distribution of borrowers in five different U.S. cities at the moment the first quantitative easing took place. And you can see that bottom line is Las Vegas. And that red line in this picture is how many borrowers have at least 80% equity in their home at the time of quantitative easing. And at the moment that it takes place in Las Vegas in November of 2008, only 20% of borrowers have at least 80% equity within their house at that time. where the comparable number in Philadelphia is like 70%. So you could see the type amount of borrowers at risk to be able to refinance differs dramatically across different types of cities at the inception of this first monetary action or the monetary action that we're focusing on in this paper. Okay. The second thing I want to show you, not surprisingly, this is well documented, the correlation between how many borrowers are underwater on the vertical axis, okay, or at least have loan-to-value ratios above 0.8, and the change in the unemployment rate up to 2008 November is highly correlated. The places that were hit hardest in terms of real activity measured by the unemployment rate going up were the places where the most borrowers were underwater. So there's this strong correlation between real activity, the unemployment rate, and house price declines, which are making borrowers underwater in the in these different cities. And here's kind of pictures. I'm going to show you a few pictures like that in my remaining time, so let me set them up for you. What I've done is clumped all of the MSAs for which we have data, so think about 300 MSAs in the U.S., population-weighted into quartiles based upon how many borrowers are underwater, measured by a loan-to-value ratio of 0.8 at November in 2008. The bottom line is going to include the MSAs like Las Vegas, where there are a lot of borrowers underwater. I'm going to refer to those as high loan-to-value ratio places. Okay. The top line is the lowest quartile of borrowers. These are going to include your Philadelphia and your Seattles in these types of metric. And at the moment that quantitative easing takes place, the first one, you see a spike in refinancing activity. They're trending very similarly before. You see a spike in refinancing activity that is much larger in the parts of the country that are doing relatively well. These are going to be these low loan-to-value type places. Okay, and this is in application data. So this is the moment using the high-resolution data. You can see applications spike immediately after the announcement, and differentially in the parts of the country that are doing relatively well. Okay, this is actually on origination data using our Equifax merging of credit records and mortgage data. And you could see, again, you see that increase in refinancing activity even in this data set between the high and low loan-to-value ratios, but it's delayed a month or two. Why? Because it takes time between when we apply for a mortgage and when the mortgage actually closes. So you could see this is actually on origination of the mortgage, and that's kind of, even though the loan the policy took place in November, you're seeing big effects in January and February because it just takes time between when an application turns into an origination. So what about people removing equity? This is going to be one channel for which we're going to be linking to real activity in the economy. You basically lost your job, the economy's suffering. You have some equity in your house. You basically want to refinance when interest rates go down, tap into home equity. You might remove some of that equity that you might be able to use for current consumption. And you can see the amount of equity being removed from the refinancing during the refinancing process in response to the quantitative easing was much bigger in the places that had equity. This is not surprising. So you could see that they tapped into their home, removed some equity during the refinancing process, more so than in the cash-out refinancing. I want to say, before I show you the next picture on spending, I just want to say we kept talking a lot about the effect of monetary policy on house values, okay, which is something you need to think about. The key thing to keep in mind is that house prices were falling a lot in all areas in this period. And monetary policy might have stopped the house pricing from falling a little bit more in one region than another, but it still didn't cause people to get equity in their house. People in Las Vegas still had essentially no equity in their home in November of 2008, and the monetary policy might have stopped it from even getting less. But the key difference is it just didn't help put equity back into people's houses. House prices continued to fall for the next, 2.5 years from the start of the recession. Okay. And this is just a measure on spending. So we have one measure of local spending that we look at in the paper, and that's new auto purchases. And you could see between the high and low quartiles of MSAs in terms of their spending on cars, or at least their purchases of cars, they were tracking nearly identical with each other until QE. Okay. You see, there's a little delay by a couple of months there. And why is that? Because by the time the origination started, the application started and turned to origination, it took about 3 months before it showed up in spending, which is exactly what we would expect if people were liquidity constrained and they needed to tap into their equity before they could actually increase their spending. And you could then see a pretty big difference in spending measured by new car purchases between the places that had equity in their home and the places that didn't have equity in their home at the time of the monetary policy expansion. So I got two more slides before I conclude. The first of which is this a common feature of all recessions? And the answer is we don't find evidence of it. So what I'm comparing now in the paper is the 2008 recession. Each one of those dots are different MSAs. About the correlation change in house price with the change in the unemployment rate. So in this recession, there was a strong relationship between unemployment growth and how much house prices changed during the recession at the MSA level. That correlation in the gray was not there in the 2001 recession. There was very weak correlation between house price growth and unemployment changes at the local level during that recession. And then when we look at differential refinancing behavior across MSAs based upon, in this case, not how much equity they have in their home, just by unemployment changes, we don't see any differential response between the two regions in this recession. If anything, you might see a stronger response in the parts of the country with the higher unemployment rate in terms of refinancing propensity. So it's, again, this correlation between collateral shocks in something like unemployment that is driving the differential heterogeneity during this recession. So just putting a little bit of back of the envelope numbers on some of this, I'm out of time. As we go through and look at how much due to refinancing cash out, how much is due to mortgage reset. So in the paper, I didn't talk about it here. We have a whole bunch of variable rate mortgages that we look at. We look at home equity lines of credit. So we look at a whole bunch of vectors of ways that households can get cash into their hand through the interest rate change from QE. And you could find, of the total effect that we find in terms of cash out into current consumption, home equity lines of credit, refinancing cash out, and reduction or changes in mortgage payments, about 15% of it went to the bottom quartile. About 30% went to the top quartile. So you could see that the distributional effects were helping more the places that were doing relatively better than the places that were doing relatively worse. So, again, this is just my summary. So it's important to understand the interaction between regional heterogeneity and monetary policy in the U.S., but in particular Europe as well. And we might want to think that the collateralized lending channel might have an effect that we need to think about. And at least during the Great Recession, that monetary policy, at least by our estimates, was exasperating regional dispersions. It was helping most the parts of the country that were doing relatively better and not helping as much the parts of the country that were doing relatively worse. And then going forward, there's a whole bunch more things that we want to think about, like who holds the assets. Whether we could think about optimal policy. That's it.
Now we're going to hear from Mark Zandi from Moody's Analytics, who, as long as I've been a reporter in Washington, is someone who we turn to help us think about the way that regions of the country differ. So, Mark.
Yeah, thank you, Dave. I can remember my first conversation with you was about the Mountain West, and I can remember you telling me, that just doesn't make sense. Yeah, I literally remember, it must have been 25 years ago, but I literally... Actually, you were right. I wasn't making a lot of sense. Yeah, I really wasn't making a whole lot of sense. Let me say a few things. First, I enjoyed the paper very much. I think it advanced the ball on our understanding of the efficacy of monetary policy. And I'm very sympathetic with your two premises. One, that if you've got an economy with a lot of different regional economies, it impairs the efficacy of monetary policy, both in terms of its sensitivity of the economy to the monetary policy change, but also in terms of the timing. I think that's intuitive, feels right to me. And also that monetary policy changes can have different regional economic consequences. That also, I think, looking at a lot of business cycles over 25 years, I think that makes a lot of sense to me. It's very, very intuitive. I do have some observations, though. First is that, and I think you said it in your paper, this is a case study. It's very partial equilibrium kind of analysis. And you focused very nicely on one aspect of QE, monetary policy, and the impact on regional economies, and that's the refinance channel and cash out withdrawal. Very important channel, no doubt, but only one of many. And I think to really truly understand the effect of QE, other monetary policy, on the regional economies, it has to be considered more broadly. So one example of that would be the impact of QE, lower interest rates, on ARM readjustment. And you mentioned this in the paper, and I think you're right. But I think you're using the wrong counterfactual. And you almost said, you said it up here. You were looking at the change in the payments resulting from the decline in interest rates. But the real counterfactual is what would have happened if the Federal Reserve had not done that and lowered interest rates. The impact on those hard-pressed regional economies would have been much more severe. I mean, if you go back to before QE, the six-month LIBOR, which is the key index rate for most of the 228 subprime ARMs that were readjusting at the time, was 4%. And right after QE, it was zero. And that made a huge difference in terms of those 228 ARMs. I can remember there was a lot of concern at the time about those exploding ARMs and what impact they would have when they actually readjusted. And the fact that they did not readjust was a huge boost to those regional economies, like Vegas, to California, to Miami, to Arizona. So very, very important. There's other channels that matter. Lower interest rates obviously help out the banking system in lots of different ways. You know, lowering the cost of funds, that was very, very key to the very hard-pressed banking system in a lot of these regional economies. One might argue that the lower interest rates were quite helpful in bringing out mom-and-pop investors that ultimately came in and caused house prices to bottom out and to rise. Without those lower rates, those investors couldn't have come in to the degree that they did, certainly not as soon as they did. And there's also a lot of second-order effects. And one of the interesting things you point out is, and you spent a lot of time on it, is the impact of the cash-outs on consumption, particularly auto sales. Well, the benefits of those auto sales actually go primarily to one of the hardest-pressed regions of the country, and that's the industrial Midwest, which was getting hammered by the collapse in the auto industry. So, you know, there was a case where, the lower rates, the cash-out refis helped a region of the economy that was struggling to a significant degree. The other thing to consider is regional mobility, very important. So even if you're lifting the stronger economies more than the weaker economies, because of the mobility in the economy, it allows for the economy to adjust much more quickly, and unemployment falls much more rapidly in places like Nevada and Arizona and California, because the Texas economy is doing a lot better, and you saw those migration flows pick up quite substantively. So even if you're only lifting the initial effect is to lift the stronger regional economies, it also has a second order effect, which I think is very important. So the bottom line is that when you consider all of these things, I think it doesn't obviate the result. I think it mitigates it, though, to a significant degree. And you can actually see it in the data today. So go look at employment in the four stand states that got creamed in the downturn, California, Arizona, Nevada, and Florida. Since the bottom of the recession, let's just use Q2 2009 as the bottom. That's the national, the nadir of the national recession. Employment in those economies is up 12%. Employment everywhere else is up 8%. Those economies have done marvelously well. Job growth in those four economies has been stronger than the rest of the nation since 2012. And by orders of magnitude, current job growth in those four economies together is 3% year over year compared to 2% for the nation. So obviously lots of other things going on, not just QE, and you're focused on QE. But, you know, I think it's it highlights the point that we need to think about this in a broader, more general equilibrium sense. I think that's very important. A couple of other observations. One other observation is that this is a case study, and it feels very idiosyncratic to me. So, for example, if I were constructing a scenario for a recession today, and the Federal Reserve does this in its stress testing every year, if you look at the last Fed stress test and the scenario that generated it, it was motivated by a global downturn, a European crack up, a Chinese recession. Okay, so if that is the motivation, if that's the cause of the next economic recession that we struggle with, and the Federal Reserve's response to that would be to lower interest rates, then that would also, the key effect of that would be to affect the value of the dollar and benefit the very same regions that are getting hit by the slowdown in global activity. So I think it depends. The case study is interesting, but I'm not so sure it translates into other types of economic shocks. It really does depend on the shock in terms of trying to understand what the impact is across regions. And the final observation I'd make is that this all may be, the relationships here may be changing pretty rapidly because the financial system is changing very rapidly. I mean, I think if we went through this kind of downturn 20 years ago before interstate banking, the regional impacts would have been much more significant than they ultimately ended up being. This go around, we had a much more nationalized banking system. So when IndyMac went belly up in San Diego, which was a very large California lender, Wells Fargo, the big national mortgage lender, could come in and kind of fill the void and do a lot of FHA lending. So the regional impacts are much less significant. And I think they'll be much less significant in the next go around because not only is the banking system now more national, but also the shadow banking system is starting to fill in the holes. And that is truly national and international. And that will, I think, in the future, mitigate some of the regional heterogeneity that would result from any change in monetary policy. Let me end by saying a couple things about what all this means for policy. Again, let me revert back to point number one. I think the paper's really good, and I think I agree with it. I mean, it makes a lot of sense to me. It's very intuitive. So let's just take that as given. And this gets to the final point. This has policy implications. Number one policy implication is that in economies that have more regional heterogeneity, we need a more aggressive monetary policy. And this is patently obvious in the context of Europe and the European Central Bank. Their regional dispersions are much, much greater than the regional dispersions that exist in the United States. And that would have argued for a much more aggressive ECB than even the Fed. And, of course, we got just the opposite. And, of course, I think that's one of the reasons why we've got such very different results here. The second implication is that in an economy with regional heterogeneity, you need more fiscal stimulus and or less fiscal austerity. And I think that also is point is very clear in the context not only of our experience but certainly of the European experience and the fact that they – went to austerity almost immediately was very counterproductive and much more so than it would have been here, primarily in part because of the great disparities in regional economies across Europe. Finally, on policy, this might be more controversial. I think it also argues that fiscal policy should be used to help facilitate monetary policy. And we got a good example of that in your case study, opening up the credit channel for more refinancing, and that was the HARP program, the Home Affordable Refinance Program, which was first implemented in 2009, got a revamp in at the end of 2011. This cleaned out that channel, and actually as of today, 3.3 million homeowners in those very distressed states got refinancings because no longer was CLTV a criteria for refinancing for a Fannie Freddie loan. It made a huge difference to those economies. And I think we need – obviously, there's a lot of political economy issues with regard to the statement that fiscal policy should be used to help support monetary policy and vice versa. But I think smart fiscal and monetary policy going forward does need to think about how to work together – to clean out those channels to allow monetary policy to work more effectively in recessions. Thank you.
Andreas is going to come in.
So in case the unfamiliar face here is Andrea Pfister from the New York Fed, who worked on this paper, and I'll say on his behalf that nothing he said has anything to do with anything that they think about at the Fed or something like that. Isn't that the standard disclosure?
No.
My favorite was somebody from the Fed gave a paper at the IMF and said, when I use the word we, and he put up a picture of Janet Yellen, I'm not talking about her and me. So I want to pick up a little bit on where Mark ended, Eric and Andreas, the kind of so what question. So monetary policy always works on an economy as a whole. You can't. It's kind of hard to target it at particular regions. So is there any lesson here for how monetary policy could have been different? And then I'll pick up on the fiscal in a minute. Do more.
You got to do more. I mean, so at the end, if the places where the people have the highest marginal propensity to consume aren't able to borrow, and you want to stimulate aggregates, so that's your goal. Your target is aggregate unemployment rate, you might have to do more just to because you're not targeting the people who have the biggest marginal propensity to consume for a given change in interest rate. So,
Andreas, you want to add to that?
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
Okay, so now. I think you raised a good question about fiscal policy, Mark, but I would have put it differently. That
of course you would have.
If you know that your monetary policy is going to work better in some regions of the country than others, then should you structure your fiscal policy, your housing policy, to complement what the Fed does? In other words, should they have done more earlier on the fiscal side for the Las Vegases? You know, HARP took a long time to get that. It was a lot of acronyms before we got to HARP.
Right.
Is that the lesson here, that if you have a housing bust and you know monetary policy in a world where you have fixed-rate mortgages so that a lot of people just don't adjust automatically, should they have designed fiscal policy with this in mind? If we had to go through this again, would that be the right lesson?
Well,
target fiscal policy.
Yeah, I think that is the lesson. I would say, though, in all fairness to fiscal policymakers, it's not like they didn't understand this, and it's not like they didn't try to grapple with it. I mentioned HARP, but there was HAMP. There's all the things that the FHA did. There was the DASP. I mean, there's a zillion and one things that were designed to address these regional problems. Stating these things and putting them on paper and then actually executing on them in the context of all the different parties that are involved is – and also given the complete mess – at lots of different levels, you know, in the servicing and in the underwriting originations. I mean, a lot of different moving parts here. It was hard to make it work well. And the one program that actually worked, in my view, well, it took a little time to get it going, but at the end of the day, was a slam dunk success, was HARP. I mean, 3.3 million people, mostly in these hard-pressed areas. I mean, you go into Nevada, to Florida, Arizona, California. These are mostly because they were underwater. You could see Eric's data. They were underwater. And by the way, I live in Philadelphia. I don't feel like I had a whole lot of equity. I don't know.
Should have bought it earlier.
<That's right. laughs> I wish I had a home in Las Vegas right now.
I think on the market.
Yeah, much less so than there used to be.
Yeah.
But I think the HARP program worked exceptionally well. But that's one of the, you know, the third thing I said about using fiscal policy to help monetary policy. Of course, you have to have a very prolonged, attenuated economic problem, you know, like a great recession, to give you the time to be able to do something like it. And a more typical kind of economic downturn, that doesn't work all that well.
But, I mean, fiscal policy in general does have regional components built into it automatically. So, you know, we could talk about HARP, you know, having some effect because it was treating people underwater, and it did have more effect in some of the stand states than others. But the key thing is unemployment benefit extensions and, you know, food stamps and all of those things are set to act in when people are out of a job or
don't meet some asset limit, and those are automatically set up. So fiscal policy is built in to do some of this automatically.
The question is,
we could always just cut a check to people in Las Vegas, and there's different ways we could cut a check to people in Las Vegas. Some of it is bailing them out if they're underwater. Some of it is extending unemployment benefits.
Actually,
and that's kind of it.
In the case of HARP, I don't consider that to be a bailout at all, right? Because this was a Fannie to Fannie, a Freddie to Freddie, transaction, and actually it made Fannie and Freddie better off because it reduces their credit risk. So that was not a
But it comes at a subsidy to other people that are being backed up at, some taxpayer dollars. So there is some in the background, some of this is going on.
I thought the loser was the person who held
the
Fannie
investor.
Freddie paper.
Exactly. Exactly. Or
their expectations, they expected prepays. They didn't get prepays because they were underwater.
Right. So hard plates for them.
Yeah, right.
So what about? Can I maybe add to HARP? So slam dunk, it happened sort of late, right? It happened 2012 is when it really took off. Secondly, non-agency borrowers were not helped by the program. So subprime alt-A borrowers that were, very prevalent in Vegas, they could not refinance under that program. So if you compare it to a world in which we had adjustable rate mortgages or mortgages that, ratchet downwards where you don't have to re-underwrite the loan, I think that even with HARP, the transmission was quite a bit weaker.
What about the Europe? Do you draw parallels? Mark made some observations about Europe.
Yeah, this is it. When you start thinking now, so there's two things about the Europe. The dispersion is bigger, so we can know the Spanish versus the Germans are bigger than, Dallas versus Las Vegas. But at the same time, they don't have an integrated fiscal system. So some of the automatic stabilizers we have built into our system doesn't exist. So when we're thinking about monetary policy as being, kind of the tool of the European Union, if it has distributional effects, if there's big values in collateral value, you don't have anything in the background to come in and offset that through automatic. And that's why you're seeing now you got to cut checks, and the Germans got to vote every time they want to cut a check to people in Greece, into the U.S. It's kind of just built in to the political process that, Las Vegas got more checks than Dallas.
So a question in the back there, and then John Sablehouse.
Good morning. Tom Pally from the AFL-CIO. Thank you very much for a very interesting paper. I'd like to try and roll the question back a little to something that Josh asked and make the connection. We know that contractionary macroeconomic policy is essentially inegalitarian, and expansionary macro policy is egalitarian. It makes sense. You're going to be improving the labor market, good for wages, good for jobs, and if you're doing interest rates, who owns capital? Interest rates is a sort of a payment between groups. But the question then is, could we have done better? And Josh kicked it off by saying monetary policy versus fiscal policy. I think since we're talking QE and we want to draw some implications for future policy, let's try and pull it back to monetary policy versus another form of monetary, alternative monetary policies. And then, of course, Josh started saying something, let's try and get to the policy implications and how we might improve future performance and make monetary policy more egalitarian. Even if it's pushing in the right direction, can we make it even better? And so here, Josh started with the idea of giving the Fed, somehow or other, the power to send people checks directly. I think that's probably it would be a good way of doing things, to address directly these things. If you think that monetary policy is some form of transfer of funds between groups, this goes to everybody getting it, and the Fed can draw it back again. If it ever wants to pull liquidity out of the system, it can use its existing powers, raise interest rates, and get people to redeposit their funds with the...
But do you see any line then between fiscal and monetary policy?
Isn't that just fiscal policy?
Fiscal policy is about buying resources. That's traditionally how we've seen it, government spending. But anyway, I just want to make a list of things that might do. That one you might question,
short
but
one.
I want to make
list.
Some others. The other thing is refi directly. Mark talked about HARP. Anyone who's... this QE, in terms of the housing market, could have been so much more effective had people just been able to jump, if we could set up some mechanisms to jump through the process so that you get direct access if you want it. I mean, I refinanced a couple of times, and I every time I had to pay $1,800 in mortgage insurance. By the way, I'd like to put that on the Brookings agenda. Can we do something about this question of always having to pay for fantastic mortgage insurance? I can't believe it's actuarially fair on defaults on property rights and so on. That's the justification every bank will always tell you. It's a fantastic fixed cost to refinancing. That's a policy consideration if we could really get
to... one more on your list. Otherwise, we won't have any time for anybody
something
to respond.
Something I've advocated for a very long time is something called asset-based reserve requirements. So, for instance, you could, and a mortgage fits that very directly, you can have different reserve requirements based on the state of housing markets. You could say new mortgages in Nevada versus new mortgages in New York. Very applicable, by the way, to Europe right now, if they had some sort of asset-based reserve requirement scheme. Finally, how about bringing back margin requirements? Looking to the future, one of the things that's driving monetary policy now has been is fears of an asset bubble. Well, let's not torpedo the economy with higher rates that might affect investment, the exchange rate, and housing. And if we are worried about an asset bubble, the Fed should be getting back into the business of adjusting margin requirements.
Right,
there's
no.
a set of
That's
policies.
Right, but that's a separate conversation. Do you want to respond to
I mean, I have lots of thoughts, but the key thing when we're thinking about, you know, the kind of the point of our paper is we've got to think about the channels of which monetary policy is taking place. And some of those have regional components to them, and some do not. Mark touched on a little bit on this. The strength of the banking sector, to the extent that the U.S. banking system is mostly national now, doesn't have much of a regional component, except to the extent that people are willing to extend credit. So if we prop up banks by having asset limits ex ante, and we still have booms and busts in local housing prices, the fact that when Fed lowers interest rates and they are making a decision about whether to make a loan based upon local collateral values, you're still going to have regional distribution well on top of that.
A lot of interesting ideas, and you know, obviously a lot of negatives and positives you have to iron out. But the one thing you didn't quite mention, which I think would be very useful in the context of future crises and recessions, would be countercyclical capital standards, right? You know, right now they're pretty much set through the cycle, and in fact, one could argue, given the way they are implemented and likely to be implemented in the future through the stress testing process, they could very well be pro-cyclical, and that is exactly the wrong way you want to do it. So you would want to set up a system where you have capital standards set counter-cyclically. And some countries effectively are doing this. So if you go look at macroprudential responses to potential housing bubbles in New Zealand or Australia or Canada or even in the UK, they're taking this counter-cyclical stance.
Don't we have counter-cyclical capital buffers in Dodd-Frank? We see whether the Fed will use
okay.
them.
Okay. We'll see how this works, but right. My gut tells me.
Basel III.
Yeah, but right. we'll see how this is actually implemented.
Fair enough. Yeah. John Sablehouse.
Thanks. I'm John Sablehouse from the Fed, so anything I say should not be held against them. But I think this is a question anyway. It's for Eric. And so what your diff analysis showed us was the lack of a positive effect in the sort of low LTV or high LTV regions. I'm wondering if the same analysis could be used to show the absence of a continued negative trend in the same areas. So, in particular, looking at defaults and new defaults that were happening. So was there anything around that time, if we drew the same sort of pictures, we would see much higher default initiations in these high LTV regions? And did that suddenly change right around the time of QE? And is that an avenue that we could sort of add to the ledger on the other side?
Yeah. So to be clear, everything that picks out, nothing's about levels. So everything's only about differences. That's kind of the design of these regional things. Anything that's general equilibrium in general could push everybody up or push everybody down, and this is only differential. So you should think about it as not these regions are not helped at all. It's just that they're helped relatively less than the good regions. So that's the first thing. When you look at things like defaults or house price changes or things that we've looked at, some of those, you don't see much differential response. And if anything, the betterness, when you kind of have to squint a little, looks like the better regions are having less house price decline. And part of this is, you know, the bad regions were overvalued to begin with. So people keep wanting to talk about propping up house prices. We're just
affecting the trend back to equilibrium. Sometimes that trend could go fast, sometimes that trend could go slow. So we know these bad regions were going down much more than the good regions just because they were much more overvalued. And you still see that. Now, when you try to look, did it slow down the trend or not? We couldn't see much avenue of differential effect between in defaults.
Yeah, you don't. So at the regional level, you don't see very much. There's micro studies that show that, you know, when the payment is lowered, the default propensity falls substantially, sort of on impact. So,
so we look at that. Yeah. So we have that in the payment reset in our things, and it doesn't look that much differential between the two regions. Again, it could have aggregate effects, but we're only picking out the relative effects, and you don't see anything else adding up in the relative effects. Between these two, the high and the low region.
Okay, let's stop here, and we can revisit this later. We're going to take a break. I'm going to try and hold it to about 5 minutes so we can get close to being back on schedule. There's coffee and some pastries out here in the lobby. Thank you guys very much. It was great. Thank you.
Thank you. So our third paper today is by Matthias Stepke and Veronica Selezneva. How'd I do? Good. Of Northwestern and Martin Schneider of Stanford. They build an economic model that helps us think about, and using actually some of the Survey of Consumer Finance data, John, that helps us think about, okay, if wealth changes, it changes differently for different sets of people in the economy. And when we think about the distributional impact of quantitative easing, when we try and answer the question, does it increase or decrease inequality, you have to look at the different categories of people and how much their wealth changes, because it's really a question of summing up the winners and comparing them to the losers. So as you'll hear, they find they use a model of where they say if the Fed sets out to increase inflation, which is kind of a proxy for QE, what happens to different groups of people, different groups of homeowners. So Matthias is going to give the initial presentation, and then we're very pleased to have Jean Bovin, who's the former deputy finance minister from Canada, who's actually done a lot of thinking about these questions now at BlackRock, to respond. Thank you.
Thanks for the introduction. It's good to be here. So this paper touches on many of the same themes we've already talked about in the first two presentations. The difference is that we approach this more from the perspective of formal macroeconomic modeling. So as we have already discussed, monetary policy works in part by moving interest rates, both the short-term real rate by setting the federal funds rate, to some extent long rates, if you think of quantitative easing having some impact on the slope of the yield curve, and perhaps most importantly, nominal rates also through inflation and future inflation expectations. If people expect high inflation, nominal rates will go up to compensate for this high inflation. So in this paper, we want to document exactly how large this distribution would be for alternative policy scenarios, and then use a formal macroeconomic model to figure out the consequences of those changes for macro aggregates and also for welfare. So compared to the previous papers, it's kind of the same question, more applied to formal modeling perspective. So the motivation for this paper, in fact, goes back some time. So now this is a concern that is very widespread with recent changes in the macroeconomic environment. But Martin and I both grew up in Germany, and as you may know, Germans have a pathological fear of inflation. You know, and so what was kind of interesting for us is that when you grow up in Germany, in elementary school, you learn that inflation is bad. They tell you this in second grade, and they tell you it's bad because of redistribution. You know, so the reason you're told about is that if inflation is high, grandma will lose her money because it's in the savings account that has a fixed interest rate. And so this is really about a redistribution effect. And then later you go to graduate school, and then you have a bunch of monetary models. All monetary models you see in graduate schools are models with only one household. There's only one person in there. There is no different household. There is no redistribution. And so this kind of dissonance between what we learned about why inflation is bad and what the models actually do, this is what the initial motivation was. And so what we're trying to do here is to use a model that has different types of people where redistribution can happen, and then use this model to figure out whether what we learned back in elementary school actually makes any sense. So that's the overall plan, which of course has now become of more current importance. So the first step of this research program is to document in the data exactly who holds nominal assets and who has nominal debt. Now, if you are a lender, you're going to lose from high inflation. It's going to devalue the value of what you have. If you're a borrower, if you have a big mortgage, it's actually great for you to have inflation because the real value of the mortgage shrinks. The house appreciates with inflation, and you're going to have a wealth gain. So the first thing you have to do is document who has what in the economy. And so for this, we use the flow of funds accounts and also the Survey of Consumer Finances. We use the 2013 edition of this, so it's kind of a very current picture of what the distribution of nominal wealth looks like in the U.S. economy. A key part of that work is to distinguish assets liabilities by maturity, because if you think about changes in inflation expectations, such as a new announcement of a higher inflation target, this will affect short and long duration assets very differently. If you have money in an account with a daily changing interest rate, you're not really that much exposed to changes in future expectations because interest rates will adjust to this. On the other hand, if you have a 30-year mortgage or a 10-year government bond, those will be the prices of those, the values of those will be highly reactive. And so in this data, we document not just who holds what, but also what the average duration is of assets and liabilities for different groups in the economy. So I don't want to talk about the data in too much detail. I'll just show you one picture for the economic aggregates. So this this picture shows you as a fraction of GDP the overall asset position of the U.S. household sector. So we simply look here at the flow of funds and sum up all the nominal assets and all the nominal liabilities. And nominal here means in terms of U.S. dollars because that's what what's affected by changes in inflation. So the green line is the assets. And then the solid blue line is the directly held debt. So this is things like mortgages. What we also account for is that you have some indirect holdings. What do we mean by this? So the household sector owns firms through stocks and also through mutual funds. And the corporate sector itself has debt also. So there's debt on the corporate side. And so if the if debt gets devalued through inflation, you would expect that the real value of holding the corporate sector goes up also. And so the total debt, the dashed blue line, essentially consolidates the firm sector into the household sector to take account of this fact. So two things you can see here is that there was a huge increase in the liabilities, in the debt of the household sector after about 1980. And you can see, in fact, that just before the crisis, the dashed blue line and the green line coincide. You know, so for a short moment of time, we had the U.S. household sector essentially being balanced in terms of assets and liabilities. And that's very unusual because traditionally the household sector was a net lender and the government was a net borrower. You know, so the government debt was financed by the U.S. household sector, and that changed massively from 1980 until 2006 or 2007 or so. This reflects the huge inflow of funds from abroad. You know, so foreigners weren't really holding many U.S. assets previously, but that changed after 1980. And by about 2006, essentially all U.S. government debt, on average, was held abroad. Of course, not you know, every single bond, because there's huge differences and in holdings. But the overall nominal investments of the foreign sector in the U.S. economy was essentially equal to government debt, and therefore the household sector is roughly balanced. So that's kind of one thing that has changed massively, and also is kind of relevant for potential redistribution implications of inflation. Then we see after the crisis, huge leveraging. So both lines drop very quickly, and so now there's a new gap opening up between assets and liabilities. Okay, but this is the aggregate picture. What we're more interested in is redistribution within the household sector. Now, so we see that the household sector as a whole has huge assets and huge liabilities. Of course, if you look at individual households, there are different households who have the assets and different households who have the liabilities. You have to distinguish those to see who gains and who loses from inflation or other changes in interest rates. And so that's what the rest of the paper does. So you can do, with this accounting framework, with the modeling framework, you can do many different experiments. The one I want to show you today, for the most part, is essentially an experiment of raising future inflation. So this is a bit related to QE, but it's more related to a change in the inflation target, which is another policy option people have been discussing recently, partly because of concerns about the zero lower bound. You know, so we have now a period of zero interest rates, not just here, but also in Japan for many years now, which has raised to questions about whether it wouldn't be safer to have a somewhat higher inflation target. And so here we figure out what would happen if the Fed were to announce a new inflation target that's 5 percentage points higher than the previous target. You know, of course, you can scale this up and down any way you want. And so the experiment is that this announcement is made, and we're going, what I'm going to show you is the outcome if after this announcement the rest of the change in inflation is fully anticipated. So people believe what's going to happen, and then everything's under perfect foresight. If there's a repeated surprise, so people don't quite believe, or if there's changes in the future also, everything is the same, only bigger. You know, so repeated surprises lead to larger redistribution effects. In our experiment, because everything's anticipated, this change will lead to a parallel upshift in the yield curve. So at all horizons, the interest rates will, the nominal rates will jump by 5%, essentially to compensate for this higher inflation. Okay, so here is just from the data and the assumed experiment, the impact on the wealth of different types of households of this redistribution. We do it in the paper for many different groups, but the most important ones to consider are these three. So the first group is renters, and on the x-axis you see the age. So these are households of different ages who happen to rent their home. At the bottom you see the rich, and the rich we define as the top 10% by net worth in each age cohort. We distinguish the rich because it is well known that the wealth distribution is highly concentrated, so there's a small percentage group at the top that accounts for most wealth holdings. So we look at those separately. And then what's left is essentially everybody else. These are people who are not rich and own their homes. So we call these middle class homeowners. What you see in the picture is the change in wealth from this, the immediate change in wealth from this new inflation path for each group expressed as a percent of GDP. Okay, so the first thing you can see from this picture is that renters are not affected. Not surprisingly, they're renting a house. They don't have a mortgage. They're also not rich. They don't have many assets. So the impact on their position could be very small. There's some, but it's small. Losses are essentially coming all from one group, which is the old rich. You know, if you look at the negative numbers there, it is rich people over about 55 years of age who are taking this hit. And this is a percent of GDP, but it is for a group that's only 2.5 years in width. So each group makes up only about 1 or 2% of the population. So a 1% change in wealth compared to GDP, if you're only 1% of the population, is actually a very large wealth change. So these older among the rich are losing a lot. And this is because the old rich have a large portfolio of bonds and savings. We talk a lot about the rich being highly invested in equity, and it's true that the ratio of equity to fixed income investments is higher for the rich compared to the middle class, but because the rich are so rich, it's still true that they still account also for most of the holdings of nominal assets. So that's why this is where the losses are. Those are the gains. The gains come from essentially from holding mortgages. You know, so the gains occur if you have debt, and the main source of debt is mortgages, and the people who have mortgages are the middle class and middle age. You know, if you're rich, you're rich enough not to have a mortgage, so the top 10% rarely have any debt at all. If you're very old, you probably have paid back your mortgage. If you're very young, you haven't bought a house yet. It's the middle income, middle age range. And so you see from about age 30 to about 50, large gains, close to 1% of GDP for these groups. And again, these are groups that are about 2% of households. So for them, compared to the income, it's a huge change in wealth, just because the mortgage typically is very large compared to household income. Many people have mortgages that are multiple of their annual household income. So we see in the aggregate essentially a large flow from the old rich to the middle class, middle-aged. Okay, and so that's kind of interesting on its own, but the next step is to figure out what does this flow of wealth does to the macroeconomy. For that, you kind of need a model. You need to understand how does the behavior of the rich-old differ from the behavior of these middle-class households to see whether these effects are going to cancel out in the aggregate or if there's something that is going to happen to the macroeconomy. So this is where the model comes in. We built a kind of fairly rich life cycle model with different types of households, the different wealth, income. There's income shocks, so income is variable over time. Also preferences. We have preferences in there because we want to capture the fact that a fraction of households is financially constrained. And certainly whether you're financially constrained, meaning you're close to a borrowing constraint or not, will have some bearing on how your consumption is going to react to changes in your wealth. And then we also have, of course, differences in the asset position. A key part of the paper, which rhymes with many of the two other papers in this session, is that we really focus on the housing sector. You know, so we saw that mortgages are kind of a very important part of the transmission of these shocks. So understanding how house prices react is going to be important. And so we have different types of houses in there. This is a renting and buying decision. And we also distinguish two segments in the housing market, small and large houses. And I will show you in a second how this is relevant. The way the model works is the smaller open economy as far as the real interest rate is concerned. So think of this as being set in world markets, but the housing market clears inside the country. You know, so there's going to be repercussions for housing prices. And then, so what we do with that formula is we calibrate the model to U.S. data. We introduce this policy change as a shock to an economy that's in the steady state. And we're essentially going to change the wealth position of each household based on what I've shown you from the data. So we're going to take the middle class, middle age in our model and make them richer or kind of lower their debt in line with what's in the data. We're going to take the old rich in our model and make them poorer compared to what's at the same amount what's in the data. And then we just compute forward what's going to happen to this economy. Let me show you kind of the main points from the results. So the first here is on housing prices. So on the axis is years, from 0 to 25 years after the shock. On the vertical axis is the percentage change in housing prices. So what you see is prices go up, but they go up only for the large houses. They actually don't go up at all for the small houses. And that was something we were surprised by initially, but it actually makes a lot of sense. So why is this? So the gains from this shock go to these middle-class mortgage borrowers. And so this increase in wealth you would expect gives you an increase in the demand for houses. You know, they're richer now. They want to have more. One thing they would have more of is houses. But a key thing about these borrowers is they already have a house, and so the demand that they have is going to be for upgrade houses. You know, they at some point want to move to a bigger house, and so the exchange of prices for the houses they want to move to, not the house they're in right now. Whereas the demand, the marginal demand for the smallest houses comes from people who don't have houses yet. These are starter houses. And the demand for those comes from renters, but renters don't gain from inflation. You know, so you do have an impact on housing values, but it's really further up in the distribution. It's not for the lowest level of houses. So if you're concerned about, for example, the very entry levels of the markets where we had kind of the biggest changes in the crisis, this policy actually wouldn't help you as much as we perhaps initially would have expected. Let me talk a bit about macro aggregates. So here's changes in aggregate consumption and change in aggregate output over the 25 years after the shock. So I'm going to say, again, a couple of things about this. The first thing to notice about these changes is that they are extremely persistent. You know, most of the time when we talk about monetary policy, we measure impacts in terms of quarters, you know, what happens 2-3 quarters afterwards. This picture is in terms of years, and you see these effects are around for many years. You know, so the impact on output peaks after 2.5 years, but it's kind of visible at least 10, 15 years after the shock. And this is because these changes come through change in wealth, and change in wealth are going to be affecting the economy until essentially cords are replaced by new cords. You know, people have to age and die, and young people have to be born for these things to go away. So these things aren't super large in impact, but they're extremely persistent. This is something to keep in mind when thinking about redistribution effects. The other thing is that the effect is in fact negative. You know, so output falls and consumption falls. And the reason this is happening is that first thinking about consumption is that the losses go to older people. In a life cycle model, the older people have a higher propensity to consume because they are working over a smaller horizon, whereas the young people have many years to consider, and so they're going to save a relatively larger fraction of their gain and not spend as much. Again, this is natural from the perspective of a life cycle model. We would have expected initially it may go the other way around because of financial constraints. You know, people are financially constrained. If they are kind of at the borrowing constraint, getting a windfall would make you spend a lot on consumption right now. And we did design the model to capture this, so we have people who are impatient who had the borrowing constraint, and still it wasn't enough. So it seems that because the gains go to essentially the people with the biggest mortgages, and those aren't the poorest people, that the age effect still dominates. Okay, so I will skip this one. Just to talk about welfare, I want to say two things about this. So the welfare effects are modified to some extent because of the impact on housing prices. You know, so if you have a direct loss to your wealth, but the house that you go up that you own goes up in value, that would mitigate to some extent the direct effect. So you kind of have to look at the model to understand the full impact on welfare. But even more important, I think, is to look at this picture and just notice the scale. You know, so everything else I've shown you at a scale where at the upper end was like a 2% change. Here the change that you see is a 10% change. And the units here are units of consumption. So what essentially 5% change means, which is what our 50-year-old middle-class households gain, is that this change in inflation makes them as much better off as they would be if you increase the inflation permanently by 5%. know, and if you have seen any macro models, a welfare change of 5% is just huge. You know, most policy changes that we consider have changes in welfare that are on the order of magnitude of a fraction of a percent, and here you get multiple percents. You know, so what I'm trying to point out here is that the stakes for welfare of particular groups are just huge. You know, so the potential impact that you would get from change in inflation if you have a large mortgage completely outweigh any other policy changes, which to me suggests that thinking about the political economy of this is actually quite important, you know, because people have very much reason to be concerned about these changes, much more so than most other macro policy changes. Okay, so we also did an interest rate shock, real interest rates. I'm out of time, so I won't go into that. Let me just say that that lowering real interest rates, in fact, turns out to be quite similar in the implications than our inflation experiment, even though the effects overall are larger in magnitude. You know? And this was touched on before, so there's some debate on whether changing interest rates is good or bad for, you know, rich or poor people. In our model, it's certainly good for the middle-class mortgage borrowers, just because mortgages get cheaper. It's bad for the old rich. And there's some debate about change in asset prices. It's, of course, true that if you have a long-term bond and interest rates fall, that the value of that bond goes up in the short term. But if you're a saver, and if saving is what you do, real interest rates just aren't going to be good for you. And this is kind of what comes out in the model. Okay, so let me summarize kind of the key points. I think the most important point to notice is that the change in welfare from inflation or other, you know, redistributive change is huge. So in that sense, the Germans had some reason, I think, to be concerned about that, because that's really what dominates if you think about a personal perspective, what you should think about inflation. The effect on aggregates are highly persistent because these are driven by wealth and they don't go away as long as the cohorts that are affected are around. The effect on aggregates tend to be downward, so a downward shift in labor supply and output, a bit different from what we may have expected. And there is an impact on housing prices, but the housing price is more affected up in the distribution as opposed to for the starter level homes. Thanks.
So thank you very much for having me here and giving me the opportunity to talk about these issues and to have had the chance to spend some time on this very interesting piece of work. So I have a few comments to make, and maybe as a way to start, I will just start with some initial considerations. So the conference, I took the topic and the question of what we're trying to address today maybe literally, and I want to preface my comment by saying that, because I think there's a lot of interesting results from the paper and that have implications beyond the questions we're trying to tackle with today. But I'm going to try to see what the paper tells us about the question we're trying to do today. And I think the question is about QE, monetary policy, unconventional policies, and their impact on inequality. I think that raises the question of what do we mean by monetary policy, and I'll make a couple of comments on this and trying to think about what they've presented here in terms of result and whether this is what aspect of monetary policy this is really talking about. And I think at the end of the day, the essence of my comment are about a distinction, I think, in terms of what we mean by countercyclical policies, monetary policy, versus what we think should be design feature of monetary policy itself. And I think this paper speaks more about the framework and the design feature than countercyclical policies and whether QE or conventional policies are bad or good for inequality. So that's the setup. I think Matthias did a fantastic job describing the paper and the result. I had prepared a slide in case he had not done that, but I will just now show that I think I've understood the paper. So it starts from the observation that we have large gross nominal positions, which means that inflation could potentially have a very important implication in terms of welfare distributions. And the experiment that is being considered here is what if the Fed were to increase its inflation target from 2% to 7% for 10 years? I'm making it as explicit as I can because I'm going to come back to that and try to think about, okay, how do we think about this experiment? Then we have an environment in which they're going to be carrying out this experiment, and the design ingredients are... We have a world where there's borrowing constraints, so that's going to explain part of the result. We also have households that are different, and they're different in terms of their age, their patients, and also we assume that there's some inequality at the outset. So these households are exogenously different in terms of the inequality outcome or the income outcome that they'll be facing during their life. And then I think there's a lot of great work being done in calibrating very carefully this heterogeneity to the full flow of funds account and the survey of consumer finance. And this is based on work that they've done before. And there's a considerable contribution being made there. What do they find? Well, they find that I think this is pretty intuitive. I mean, it's not obvious that all of these results will have carried out automatically, as was mentioned in the presentation. But I think, I mean, if you boil it down, we see that inflation redistributes wealth away from the asset-rich elderly in this setup towards the more indebted middle-aged middle-class homeowners, which have typically large mortgages. Doing that, it pushes the price of larger house higher, or the higher end of that segment, because these middle-income people now that have been receiving this windfall are trying to upgrade their house. Again, I think this is pretty intuitive. And finally, inflation reduces aggregate consumption and output ultimately because the middle-class households have a lower propensity to consume. They have a longer lifespan ahead of them, allowing them to be more patient. Based on that, the author's, I think, interpretation conclusions are that inflation has quantitatively large redistributive effects, and this is an important result because we haven't been exploring the implication in terms of redistribution of monetary policy that extensively, and having mechanism where you can see that in action, I think, is very important. And the authors suggest that this makes changes in monetary policy contentious from a political point of view. They also conclude that inflation may have a contractionary impact on activity, which is, again, very interesting and maybe counterintuitive. And finally, we have some implication for the housing market, which we've been discussing, and I won't dwell on that. So what do I take away from this in terms of how I think about monetary policy? And I think this has implications for the design of policy frameworks. At the Bank of Canada, back in 2011, we went through a process of renewing our inflation target, and we had to think about questions like, should we move to a price level target instead of an inflation target, or should we think about changing the level of that inflation target? Interestingly, at the time, the question was more to lower that inflation target as opposed to increase it. So we went through this, and the distributional questions, like kind of models that have been displayed here, were part of the kind of analysis that we've done at the time. And I think this is very relevant. So I think the paper by itself speaks to the question of what's the right level of the inflation target. As was mentioned during the presentation, this is a relevant question. It's on the table right now. I don't think personally it should be on the table. I think it's the wrong moment to be thinking about this, but I think we should first achieve our inflation target collectively around the world and then talk about changing them. But it is on the table. I mean, it started with, a few years during the crisis with Blanchard and Rogoff, I think, raising that. The Bank of Canada, in fact, has been doing a couple of speeches recently where they have mentioned that this is a question they're studying as part of their renewal for 2016. And there was a lone FOMC member in the last minute that has raised that as well, I believe, from the last minute. So this is on the table. And I think this paper shows another channel potentially why it could be costly to do so. If the intent is really to stimulate the economy, it seems to be working in the opposite direction because it would be contractionary in terms of output if you just look at the output implication. But in that context, I have to say the paper, I mean, we were talking about inequality here, and I wasn't sure where the others were coming down in terms of what it means for inequality. So we have in their setup, people are born unequal by construction. You can either be born rich or as part of the masses, as they put it in the paper. And inflation creates some redistribution in that context towards from the elderly to the middle-income people. And so should we think of that? And I don't think this is what, given the German upbringing, I'm not sure that this is what was in the mind here, but I think it might suggest, if you just look at the result on the face of it, that it might not be a bad thing for inequality if this is what you're looking after. Inflation might actually be redistributing progressively wealth. It's an arbitrary, potentially, redistribution of wealth, but it some people could see that as maybe an outcome of that trend. So I think a question is what do they make out of this implication for inequality? And the more general point is, in this case, for monetary policy to have something to do in terms of redistribution and inequality, you need to have inequality to start with. So you have to assume that. And I think that that's maybe something for the panel, but I think it begs questions about when we're talking about QE affecting inequality or unconventional policies, what is really behind the inequality that we're exacerbating potentially. I think I have a couple of minutes, so let me make a couple of more points. Even if the question is about the inflation target, I'm wondering if this is the right experiment to look at. And let me just explain, and again, taking things literally here, we have a 500 basis points increase in the inflation target, which means 65% increase in the price level over 10 years. So I think this is huge. People are talking about potentially raising the inflation target, but I think one of the reasons is because the neutral rate might be lower now for reasons that were mentioned in the first session. I think if you look at the survey of economic forecasts for the FOMC, it's a few basis points lower now from where they were thinking a few years ago. Dudley made a comment back in February that he thought that the long-run value of the Fed funds rate was 3.5 as opposed to 4.25. So I think we're talking about like something in the order of 75 basis points. And then maybe you say, well, the crisis has shown us that on top of that, the likelihood of hitting the zero lower bound is significant, so you want to add some cushion. So maybe you're at 100 basis points, 200 basis points, maybe. But I think 500 basis points is out of the realm of at least the question, the level of inflation target I would consider seriously. And so then the question is, if that's the question we're after, are the results quantitatively important? And I think there are questions around that because now we're cutting the shock by, it's a two-fifth of the shock now. I think this is a nonlinear model, which would tend to make a bigger shock have even a bigger impact. So I think we end up with a much smaller impact on consumption and output. And also there's another question about the increase being permanent as opposed to being only for 10 years. So these are design questions of the framework. The model might allow to do more, but based on the design, I think questions we need to think about. I'm out of time, so I just want to finish with a couple of things. I think this experiment is useful to think about a 1970s style of situation where you have inflation that goes up by a 500 basis points, and I think this is kind of the order of magnitudes you would want to calibrate for the 70s. But then in that case, I think I would see the implication as not being really about monetary policy and its implementation, but about the consequences of doing policy mistakes. I don't think any central banks are intending to reproduce the 70s outcome, I hope at least. And in that case, I think this is really about inflation, the cost of inflation, which is important, and it's a design of policy, but less about whether policy itself and its implementation has a distributional impact. This is getting into a kind of G20 wordsmithing type of things. If I had to negotiate that text, I would say that changes in inflation target should be politically contentious, not really the policy regime. Because in fact, I think this is why we think in Canada that the agreement on the level of inflation is a political decision, and it should be jointly decided by the government and the Bank of Canada, which is a separate question from the implementation of policy and unconventional policies. So that's where I'm going to leave it with minus 2 minutes. And again, I want to reiterate that this is about the question of this forum, but I think this is a very important piece of work.
So I'm going to keep this short, but come please sit up here for a minute. Matthias, sit down. And Matthias, I wonder if you could start by, if you wanted to respond at all to what Jean said.
So thanks for your comment. I basically agree with most of what you say. So it's of course true. The experiment we do is a large change, not exactly what we would expect to be implemented in the next few years. This is, you know, at this stage, just more exploring what the model does, and so then kind of a drastic experiment makes it a little bit easier. But of course, you can use the same framework to assess all kinds of policy options now, and so some of this work still has to be done. This nonlinearity, I think, though, it goes slightly the other way, because the thing that makes things nonlinear is Bayesian constraints, essentially. You know, so if people are up against Bayesian constraints, they behave differently compared to being away from it. And because the experiment we do that is one that relieves Bayesian constraints, it moves people away from the maximum, because it lowers that, it would in fact be, I think, likely be nonlinear in the other direction. So it would certainly be smaller, but I don't think more than proportionally smaller in terms of the impact. So that's just in terms of the experiment. In terms of the aggregate, it's true the output effect on aggregate is relatively small, and I think it's kind of fair to say that this is probably not the main reason that that monetary policy or inflation changes would affect output. I should also point out, however, that in this paper we have only looked at one aspect, which is the distribution within the household sector. And another thing that kind of is a bit visible from the very first picture is that one thing that's also going to be important is a distribution between the broad sectors, namely the households, but also the government and the foreign sector. And this is a picture that has completely changed because, as I mentioned with this picture, by this point, we have a huge amount of assets being held by foreigners and also huge government debt. You know, and so some of the potential benefits from inflation would come from deflating some of the government debt at the cost of foreigners. And you can think of this very differently depending if you're foreign or not. But this is, I think, something that would also factor into the picture. So if you think, for example, about the debate in Europe, it's not so much about kind of rich Germans versus poor Germans. It's to some extent about relieving to some extent the pressure of high sovereign debt around the EU zone, and that's something you would also have to factor into account. So just to say that that even though the output effect is small, I think there's a bit more to the aggregate effects than we show in this partial analysis.
Let me see if there's a question or two, and if not, we'll go right to the panel. Yes, Eric, you want to? Eric, wait for the mic, please.
Sorry, is there a quest motive in the model? How do we think about the fact that you know, parents have kids, and if they get worse off, then maybe they could just save a little less and transfer to the kids?
Right. Mm-hmm. So the model has a bequest motive, although the one I've shown you doesn't have that operative yet. That's just a function of how far we have gotten with this. We had an earlier version where the bequest motive is there, and in fact, we do need the bequest motive to make the rich rich enough. Now we do it in a slightly different, more reduced way. But we know that bequests are highly concentrated, you know, just like wealth is, and so getting bequests is a big reason why the rich, you know, have so much wealth. And so putting that back in there will make the declining consumption among the rich smaller. And so some of this effect will go away. In the past, when we had it in there and used that to reproduce wealth, it wasn't really enough to do much of an impact. You know, so that's true, it's a concern, but based on what we've done previously, I'm kind of confident it will not be kind of a crucial issue for the overall effect.
The gentleman here.
Yeah, I'm a little bit puzzled by the last paper. No, in my long life in economic, by the way, I'm Vito Tanzi from the IMF, formerly from the IMF. I've heard a statement by Friedman that the right rate of inflation is -2. Then we had the Dornbusch at one point, he said 40% would be okay. Then when we had the 7% inflation, we worried about indexation of taxes. So first of all, does it make sense to say that really the Fed can bring about a 7% inflation and keep it there? Do they have the tools to do that? And second, can they make this an unannounced statement? I mean, people were dreaming. How can you one day wake up and say we are going to bring 7% and nobody else had anticipated it? It makes no sense to me.
So let me say a couple of things about this. So so there's certainly a long debate about whether the target should go up, and I think the ability to maintain a higher target is a big part of that. You know, and so that's there, and our paper is not about that. It's about a different part of this debate. I would say, however, that certainly in history we have observed large changes in inflation that were driven by policy. You know? So you have seen the 1970s where inflation went up in many countries. By the way, differentially in many countries. So in Germany, much less so than the United States, for example. So there was, I think, some impact
Bragging.
Of monetary choices. And there was also the disinflation in the 1980s, which is kind of the same experiment in reverse. You know, if you look what disinflation did to U.S. households, it's the same thing, just with the negative sign. You know? So I think if you think of this as applicable to analyzing episodes of large change in inflation. I think we have seen many of those, and so it's very relevant from that perspective. Now, in terms of policy, what's kind of crucial here is that, of course, that this is something that has to be, you know, to be effective, to be surprising, you know, because if everything is completely anticipated, interest rates would adjust kind of ahead of time, and there would be no redistribution. You know, so everything, when you talk of inflation redistribution, is about surprises. And so so you could do this as a policy, maybe it's a one-time windfall, but this is really not about a systematic policy that you could do on a regular basis. What you could do, and this is a more sophisticated policy which we haven't talked about yet, but is to have something that's systematic, but it's linked to the business cycle, where you do some kind of, you know, pro or counter-cyclical variation in inflation to try to alleviate the burden of debt, for example, in a more strategic manner. You know, but there's some steps to be taken for sure from the analysis we've done so far to something of that kind.
Okay, can I just clarify what you make out of the paper to make sure I understood the conclusion? Are you advocating actually this experiment as something that should be considered? If so, is it because it reduces inequality? And how do you look at the inequality implication versus the contractionary impact on output? Where do you land on this?
So, given that it's a paper on a partial aspect of a policy, I wouldn't, you know, take this paper as an ultimate recommendation for policy. You know, so it's really more trying to have one tool to assess the implications of a policy like this in one dimension. In terms of my personal view, I do think that the impact on output is there, but it's not particularly large. So I think whatever the decision is going to be, it's not going to be driven by this output effect. I think of the potential desire to increase inflation is driven by something else. I think it's driven to some extent, certainly in Europe, you know, by the desire to lower the burden of debt, and partly of governments, but also partly of the private sector, which is not here, but I think this is an important consideration. And I think that's kind of the key aspect, and we want to understand what are the implications of that. In a place like the United States, you could also think about increasing inflation as a potential tax on foreigners who hold many U.S. assets, which is, you know, somewhat mischievous, I guess, but it's certainly something that for aggregate welfare would be relevant.
But what you say, someone will take you up on that.
Yes, Brian, but I think it was more as trying to understand the consequences.
Do you want to weigh in on that or anything?
I would consider that as a side effect of monetary policy rather than the target.
I mean inequality.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, I think we're going to move to the panel, although we don't have enough chairs up here for everybody. So if Don and Kevin and Susan can come up. Jean, you stay here.
Yep. Kevin, do you mind bringing me?
And then I'm going to ask the authors to feel free to participate from the floor.
Former vice chair of the Federal Reserve. Kevin, I want to start with you. I think somebody quoted you without attributing it. The quantitative easing is kind of like reverse Robin Hood, you once said. So what I've heard this morning is a whole bunch of people saying, maybe quantitative easing doesn't have the effect on inequality that a lot of us thought when we just thought about this crudely as lifting stock prices. But where do you think it did? And so... Yes. Defend your position.
Sure. So thank you, and thank you for having me here. I appreciate my security blanket and Don being with me. Don sat next to me at the Fed for 5.5 years. So to the extent we disagree, I'm sure he's right. He used to pass me a note, but now with Susan here, it's going to be more difficult. So I'll begin, I think, by just trying to frame David's question. That David and Brookings called together this conference, I think, says that distributional consequences matter to the conduct of public policy. And we central bank types, some of whom were supportive of QE at different phases, some of whom weren't, should not be defensive about this question. And the idea that distributional consequences should be sort of somehow beneath us central bankers and we wouldn't talk about it is wrong. We talk about the efficiency and efficacy of any policy, fiscal policy, monetary policy, et cetera. We also talk about the distributional consequences.
David, if someone rolls out a new fiscal policy, a new tax reform plan, the front pages of all the newspapers will say, well, who are the winners and who are the losers? So I give you and Brookings enormous credit saying this matters, and we shouldn't sort of treat it as somehow not right for central banks to take it into consideration. At the end of the day, we should all be very modest about our conclusions, both from Josh's paper, which I thought was terrific, and my own judgments on this. Quantitative easing was created by Don and others and myself, including me in the depths of the crisis, and I was a huge supporter of QE1. Ended up being quite a bit of a different view by the time of QE2 and beyond. But it was created to deal with a certain problem that was in the markets. And I would say that it has become such a long-lived product and is a product now that is used by virtually every central bank around the world, tells us that even if our judgment on the risk reward in the depths of the crisis were one thing, we should be thinking about it in a different context now. As a first approximation, I do think what we did was radical or new or novel and unprecedented. So none of us should think that we've got the answers on it. However, it does strike me as though quantitative easing is fundamentally different than cutting interest rates, and that it appears to be working through fundamentally different transmission channels. No longer credit channels and lending channels appear to be the dominant way in which it impacts the economy. It appears much more to be working itself through asset prices, whether you think about housing stocks or financial stocks. I think that is the dominant channel. And as a first approximation, if 3/4 of our fellow citizens get 96% of their income from labor income, it strikes me we ought not be dismissive in saying, oh, everybody wins. We talk about trickle-down economics in the conduct of fiscal policy, and we should ask ourselves, as Brookings is today, what are the impacts here? At the end of the day, my view is because the asset transmission channel is the dominant channel, and because those assets are held not so much or in and of itself by rich people, but it's held by people with big balance sheets, a lot of sophistication, an openness to liquidity, a sophistication about what central banks are trying to target, and a view that they have liquidity, so that they would react differently versus those that are at lower quintiles of income strikes me as something that is quite plausible. And when I look at the wealth creation across the financial asset world post-crisis, I view that wealth creation as being significantly above what my former colleagues predicted. When I look at what they expected in the real economy, I look at the real economic performance as markedly worse than they predicted. And so that's what I think raises these questions, makes them absolutely germane to today's discussion. And I very much do worry, as I'm sure many of the people in this room do, that we've created a product not with bad intent. We've created a product that may or may not turn out to be counterproductive. We are in the middle of this experiment as we are now, but where the gains have been extracted by the most well-to-do, by the most sophisticated, who see that the central banks are, to one degree or another, trying to get asset prices up to drag up the real economy. They get the joke. They have been willing to play the game. And it does strike me as though we have to think about not just the efficacy of these programs, but really who are the winners and the losers. And because we are in the middle innings of this game, it reminds me, David, a little bit when you came to visit Don and me and you were doing a book on Bear Stearns and the financial crisis was among us. It was hard to judge the prudence of any individual decision. Having this discussion now is great, but I think neither Josh nor I nor Don want to give you definitive answers.
Don, definitive answer?
I agree with the last part of what Kevin said. And I agree with the first part. I think this is a good discussion to have. I do not think that the Federal Reserve should target particular income distributions. The Fed has been given jobs by Congress. Maximum employment, stable prices, and financial stability as part of it. And there are certainly intersections between what the Fed's done and those things. And the distribution of income affects the channels by which these things, as Kevin was noting, can be effective. But I think it would be wrong for the Federal Reserve to say, we are going to steer away from our maximum employment stable price target or take longer to get there because we think getting there as rapidly as we can will have effects on income or wealth distribution that are adverse. Those are decisions for Congress to make through taxes and transfers, not for the Fed to make. I thought today's discussion was really good and really interesting because, and this goes to the last point Kevin made, because it really illuminated the channels that were working and that weren't working in order to make monetary policy effective. And the Fed needs to understand that so it can make a determination about how much monetary policy it needs to do to hit its primary goals, to get aggregate demand up to aggregate supply and to keep prices at its objective. And it might inform a conversation between, this is Josh's point, between the Federal Reserve and the Congress. So if the Federal Reserve said, here's what we're doing, and it's having these effects on income distribution, and we're, you know, it's up to you, the Congress, whether you're comfortable with this, and there are other ways of approaching this, and you might want to use fiscal policy, as Josh was discussing. That conversation never occurred. In fact, the people who are uncomfortable with quantitative easing often said it relieved the Congress. They didn't like the, quote, moral hazard because they said it would cause the Congress not to tighten as much as it should. So, in fact, the people opposed to quantitative easing were saying we want less quantitative easing and more fiscal restraint, which I think would have been a disaster for the U.S. economy.
Susan, so Kevin made a couple of interesting assertions. One of them was that asset purchases, quantitative easing, is fundamentally different from lowering short-term interest rates. Do you agree with that?
Well, for that to be true, you have to believe in the wealth effect on consumption. And so we've talked about equity prices and home prices, and economists debate the extent to which there is a wealth effect from consumption, particularly in this period of time where, so you have equity prices rebounding, but from very low levels, which may weaken any kind of wealth effect on consumption from the rebound in equity prices, and the same with home prices. I mean, we're talking about recovery from very low levels. So I am more skeptical that there was a lot of wealth effect on consumption, and that the much more direct and measurable impact is simply on interest and debtors who are saving money on interest payments versus holders of cash and other deposits that are losing money.
So that's more like conventional monetary policy.
More like conventional.
Kevin, I always thought that that the Fed always worked through the housing channel. When they cut short-term interest rates, that's where they looked for things to happen. So how is buying mortgages different than cutting interest rates?
So I'll answer that two ways. First, in order of magnitude, what the Fed has done during this cycle makes our predecessors look like pikers. So that's one. Two, I would say that asset purchases find their way into asset prices through our actual purchases, but also through signaling. And I think that the Federal Reserve in the depths of the crisis and to this day remained aggressive in quantitative easing is a signal to sophisticated financial markets that asset prices are more than ever the predominant channel through which policy will find its way into the real economy. Did in the old days, the good old days pre-2007, did the Fed believe that by changing short-term rates they would have an impact at the long end of the curve, that that would find its way into asset prices? You bet. But if you take what central bankers here in the U.S. take seriously about the problems of the zero lower bound, in so doing, what they are really saying is that this is a step change in our reaction function. We're trying a new tool. It isn't easy, and we're not sure of the transmission mechanisms. And my judgment is that is the Fed data dependent as they're thinking about policies? You bet. But rightly or wrongly, markets have also come to the judgment that they're asset price dependent too.
John, you can respond to anything you want, but let me offer one thing. So Kevin had this very clever observation that the real economy has done worse than the Fed had hoped, and asset prices have done better than the Fed had expected, QED. So is that a right, useful way to look at it?
Yeah, and actually I think this is speaking directly to something that is a bit puzzling me in the discussion we've been having today. I think, I mean, my prior is the opposite in terms of Q, the opposite of the presentation in terms of, I think QE had a massive impact on asset prices. And the way I get to that conclusion, it's very simple. I mean, I've looked at all the, and at the Bank of Canada, we went through the analysis and did all of that. It's very difficult to get a clean measure of the impact of QE on asset prices. And in particular, when you look at these windows around announcement, which would be the nice way of looking at an event, you have to assume some kind of market efficiency or that everything gets to be priced in very quickly. I think what I see, and I mean, you can look at the ECB this year, what we see is a portfolio rebalancing channel that takes time to play out. I think it's very difficult to decide to devise an experiment that will allow us to really see what's the impact. But I do see a massive thesis out there that, I mean, if you look at the investment in Japan or in Europe, it's entirely driven by a QE kind of thesis. We think that, and the way you can actually see that is this kind of narrative that bad news is good news, because bad news means more QE and that support asset prices. So I think we see, I think this is suggestive of a pretty significant impact on asset prices. And if I can go from there, I think I'm very sympathetic, I think, to the starting point that Kevin was putting on the table. Where I'm not sure I reach the same conclusion, or I'm not sure where the conclusion is, because you've ended up saying we have to be very humble about, there's a lot of uncertainty. I'm not sure I'm reaching the same conclusion is, I think it's very difficult to get out of the argument that what's the alternative. I don't see an alternative that would have created something better, at this stage, and doesn't take away the inequality consequences, but it's difficult to undermine this argument. But to me, I think it's maybe another issue of framing the question, which is we take the crisis as given. I mean, all of the discussion has been like, a crisis has occurred, policy has responded, what's the impact on inequality? I think there's another debate out there, which is lean versus cleaning. Should central banks play a role in avoiding the buildup of imbalances? And to me, when I think about inequality, I would tend to think that the culprit is more the crisis than the response to the crisis. And then the question is, was there anything we could have done to prevent or mitigate the buildup of imbalances before the crisis? I think that's why we have pushed for the reform agenda on the financial sector. That's why we are doing a lot of revamping of policy frameworks. I think one question that I don't think we have fully completely grasped is the extent to which monetary policy in the phase prior to the crisis is actually might have something to do with that. And that might be where there's a bigger question about inequality for monetary policy than the response after the fact.
You want to respond to that, Don?
So that's a very legitimate question. My personal preference would be to keep the Fed focused on maximum employment, stable prices, their inflation target, and use other tools to deal with the buildup of imbalances, if at all possible. And one of the tools that occurred to me as I was listening, particularly to the regional thing, was LTVs. So one of the lessons of the regional paper was that the easing of monetary policy has been less successful. The shortfall in demand comes in part because the transfer from lenders to borrowers, from low MPC to high MPC spenders, has been short-circuited or cut off or less effective because of people were underwater on their mortgages. By the same token, I think part of the buildup into the crisis was a leverage buildup in the household as well as the financial sector. And wouldn't it make monetary policy more effective as well as help financial stability if, as these asset prices, the house prices were rising, regulated LTVs were regulated, and they came down.
Loan to value ratios
for mortgages. And then as house prices fell, they would allow, first of all, people would have more equity. They could use the lower rates, and you might allow even higher loan to value ratios. So it struck me that these guys had come up with another reason for using loan-to-value ratios as a counter-cyclical tool.
And that's not currently in the Fed?
No.
Susan, you look like you wanted to say something.
No, I completely agree. Macroprudential policies to be a counter-cyclical force to prevent the buildup of excessive debt is the right policy tool, not monetary policy, conventional or unconventional.
Kevin, you didn't speak to the question. You made clear that you thought QE3 did not, the benefits were not great enough to compensate for the costs. And you've been very eloquent about how some of those costs are the rich got richer. But what Josh Bivens pointed out is, well, if you're a monetary policymaker, you can't say, I wish we had more fiscal policy. So is it your, well, you can say it, but you can't do anything about it. So, of course, that seems to be true if you're president of the United States, too, so the Fed shouldn't feel so bad. but so is it, what is your view on the political economy of this? If the Fed had done less, do you think the Congress would have done more, and then we would have had less inequality?
So I know I don't know isn't very compelling, but a couple things. One is there is no QED and QE. We are in the middle of this, so I don't mean to be saying that there's any proof of this.
I got
to
write that down. There's no QE. That's very good.
And the unwind of this, we are all speculating.
Right.
And if the unwind were as simple as it is in an academic model, then who knows, maybe the Federal Reserve would have felt quite comfortable already moving off of zero. So there are plenty of risks associated with that. I can't help but think that those that are last into the housing markets, last into risk markets like the stock markets, are going to be the ones who get caught holding the ball. Another distributional consequence or sophistication consequence we should care about. But your question about the political economy, so I don't know, but I would just suggest this. If you are Democrat, Republican, doesn't matter, in the Congress, and for 6 or 7 years your neighborhood central bank says, based on our projections, the economy next year will be materially stronger. That is, in 2009 and 2010, we'll have 4% GDP. Even in 2014 and 15, next year will be a percentage point stronger because in part of the prudent monetary policy being taken. Tell me what's the willingness, the courage, the interest in making a really tough choice? Because things are going to be swell if you continue to sit on your hands. So my view is, imagine the Federal Reserve, Don Cohn in a big testimony in front of the Congress, or the chairman of the Fed in Humphrey Hawkins, gets a bunch of mean questions from 100 senators about why is the economy in my district so weak and what are you doing about it? Imagine if Don or the chairman said, well, with all due respect, Senator, to you and your 99 colleagues, we pulled a rabbit out of the hat in the financial crisis. That is what the Federal Reserve was born to do. We were born coming out of the panic of 1907 to respond in the 2007 panic, and we think on balance we did a pretty good job. On the margin, we could have certainly done things better. But if you're asking us to take an economy whose growth rate is unchanged through the last $3 trillion of QE, where if you showed up here from Mars, we would have grown at almost exactly the same growth rate on a four-quarters basis, in spite of promises that we'd be doing much better, what if we leveled with the political authorities and said 2% is about what we can do by ourselves? And if you want this economy to be growing at historic trend, if you want this economy to be growing at 3% plus, there is preciously little your central bank can do. Now, if there is a shock to this economy, we remain a powerful group, and there are things we could come up with. But to get to the next level of growth, we need you. So when I come back in front of this committee 6 months from now, you would say, as your Humphrey Hawkins testimony, if the economy is not better, let me be clear whose responsibility that is. I think that's a very different dynamic. I don't know what the results will be in the political climate. But if the central banks continue to overpromise and underdeliver, there will not be a burden on our elected representatives. And I just as soon, having taken the burden on ourselves in the depths of the crisis, as we were born to do, that we try to share the burden come 2015, 7.5 years later.
So you want me to believe that members of Congress looked at the Fed forecast and decided they didn't need to do something, and that was the factor in the sequester and all that?
So let me start again with, I don't know.
Okay. Good answer.
but I do think on balance that the central bank and the OMB and the Congressional Budget Office and the World Bank and the IMF said we were always a few quarters away from escape velocity, on balance makes politicians, not all but some, unwilling to sort of sign up for a very tough choice where there's going to be winners and losers and tough constituencies. This is not to suggest, as some of my friends would, that there's no role for central banks. There's a powerful role for central banks. But the central banker role, it strikes me, and this might be unpopular in the room, is a powerful role, but it's a narrow central bank. And it's a central bank that shows its wings in panics, but in benign times, after 7 years of chronically missing its forecasts, maybe a little burden sharing would be in order. And if the politicians take us up on it, that would be a wonderful thing. And if they don't, it would still be a good thing. Because the truth is, when I joined the Federal Reserve around the time that Chairman Bernanke did, and Don had been there for a long time, when all of us new folks showed up, the central bank had a lot of institutional credibility. It had nothing to do with us. And I worry about overpromising. I worry that we can single-handedly do this by ourselves. And I just assume we try to crowd in some other good policies. And you're right, it might not work.
John, how does this look to you from outside the United States?
I think it's very difficult to get this coordination right. I mean, we've been spending quite a bit of time at the G20 table discussing what the world needs to get out of this. And 2013 was a U.S. story in an important part in terms of uncertainty around the politics on the fiscal side. And I think it's a valid question to ask if, as a result, the central bank hasn't been overburdened and had to be going deeper into some of these unconventional policies as a result of that. So I think it is a valid question about what's the right policy mix. At the same time, how you get this coordination in a world where I truly believe that central banks should be independent. So you need to get this kind of outcome-driven kind of coordination. And I can see why politics would trump that in the short term and even more for the short term for a significant amount of time.
Yeah. It's interesting that the Bank of Japan tried Kevin's approach, right, for 5 years. They lectured the rest of the government about what they needed to do, both on the supply and demand side of the Japanese economy, ended up with a new government and a new program that was part of the new government. So that doesn't mean it wouldn't have worked in the United States, but it didn't seem to work in Japan. They had to turn the central bank and the government over and embark on a new set of policies. I think the Fed has to do... I agree that perhaps, I don't know, I'm not in the minds of the politicians who are listening, that the optimism by the Federal Reserve about future growth took a little pressure off the Congress and perhaps enabled them to engage in more easily in restrictive fiscal policy. I don't know. I don't really think they pay a lot of attention to the Fed's forecast, but I'll grant that hypothetical possibility. But I do think the Fed needs to do everything in its power to hit the goals that the Congress gave to it. That's what it's supposed to do in a democratic society. So when it falls short on its forecasts, when the unemployment rate isn't falling or is falling for the wrong reasons, labor force participation is going down, I think this, whatever, it's got to guess what fiscal policy is going to be and then double down on the monetary policy to hit its goals. There's got to be one agency in the United States governmental structure that takes its goals seriously and does everything it can to hit those goals. And to say, I'm not going to do more to hit those goals because it's your responsibility, that would not have been comfortable to me as a member of the Federal Open Market Committee.
John, you mentioned in your slide something that I'd like you to elaborate on. You said that the Bank of Canada thought about the distributional implications of alternative monetary policy regimes. What was that conversation like, and is it consistent with the direction of the effects on inequality consistent with what we've been hearing this morning, or different?
So back in 2010, leading up to 2011, in Canada, every 5 years, we have to renew our inflation target. In the lead up to the 2011 renewal, there was a lot of work being done on thinking about what have we learned from the crisis? Does it require changes to the policy framework? And what would those be? One thing that was on the table at the time was whether a price level target might not be appealing.
There's a lot of theoretical argument to make it appealing. You would have, in the current environment, a lot more to go in terms of catching up on the price level. So that would suggest more easing. You might think that people will then be convinced that more easing is coming, so there'll be expectation effect as well. And in that context, one of the questions was, what are the distributional impact of this? So that's one angle. I think there's another Canadian angle that I'll just offer that I think is pertinent for the conversation, is the fact that we didn't go into unconventional policy, but we had low interest rate like everybody else for a while now, and we've seen a buildup of vulnerabilities in the household sector, the housing sector building up. And as a result of that, the government took some measures, and it tightened up the mortgage rule, as you were suggesting before, as a countercyclical policy. And then those rules were mainly targeted for a high loan-to-value ratio, which were where we were seeing more vulnerabilities, and those are people that typically don't necessarily have high income. So if you follow that train of logic, I mean, you have to realize or to conclude that monetary policy does have maybe indirectly, but does have distributional consequences. I think this is about trying to get the right mix between macroprudential policies and monetary policy. Again, I agree with what Don was saying before. I think the primary objective, and what Susan was saying as well, the primary objective of monetary policy should be the inflation target and stabilizing the economy. I think the financial stability aspect of it should be first and foremost on the macroprudential authorities, and I think these are the first line of defense. I do think that we have a remaining residual question, which is to the extent that monetary policy is actually contributing to excessive risk-taking. When does it come something that we need to take into account? And that's about preventing crisis and things of that like, which I think is a first-order thing for inequality.
Hmm, absolutely. Susan, one of the things that Matthias said that I hadn't actually thought about is that the world has changed in many ways in the last quarter century, but one is that the U.S. government has increasingly financed itself from abroad. And he had the kind of flip thing that maybe a little more inflation here would be good and would just export the cost to the rest of the world. So when we think about this questions of the impact of quantitative easing and low short-term rates forever. How do we think about the global side of this? And how does the distributional implications work if we think of ourselves as the U.S. versus the rest of the world?
Well,
you can't say I don't know. Only Kevin gets to guess that one.
Okay. all right, then I'll try to know. you can look at the same interest income thing that I talked about for U.S. households, you can look at the rest of the world sector. They've been clear losers from very low interest rates. And so foreign creditors, to the tune of several hundred billion dollars a year or over the course of this period, have lost out on interest they would have otherwise earned. So it's already a good deal for the U.S. to have extremely low interest rates on government debt. It's good for the government. They can borrow more. They could have undertaken even more fiscal stimulus, or conversely, that we've undertaken less austerity, and the rest of the world has paid. It's interesting, I think, that his paper pointed out now if we go for some inflation, which is a big if, how could we even get to the 2% target, much less beyond? That would be another way of essentially helping the U.S. And, you know, we benefit from having the world's reserve currency. And as David, I think you alluded to earlier, you can say what you want about the U.S. dollar and the U.S. economy, but we are blessed by our competition.
All right. Gentleman here on the aisle.
Hello. My name is Kamal Khanna. The last time inequality in the U.S. was this level was just before the major depression in 1929. And following the depression, there were a lot of inquiries, commissions, and policy changes that led to eventually less income equality. This financial crisis, there were similar inquiries, but they just fizzled. All they had was two partisan responses. And one hypothetical question I have is, what if Department of Justice had put 50 or 100 Wall Street executives, bankers, mortgage bankers in jail? Would it have had any impact on the income inequality?
Uh,
I'll answer it, because they don't have the guts. I think it might have had a big impact on the political economy of the thing, but it wouldn't have had much impact on income inequality. Angel, do you have a question?
Thank you. So for those who think that QE and
Intel... Tell them who you are.
Sorry, Angel Ubide from the Peterson Institute. From those who think that QE has a differential impact with respect to interest rates, and QE has mostly an impact through asset prices, wouldn't it follow that at the time of tightening, the Fed should start by selling assets rather than raising rates? And if not, why?
Kevin?
I think we knew who that question was directed towards.
Try to help here.
So I take those. I take each of those assumptions on board. As I recall, Don, when we adopted a balance sheet expansion regime, when we were confronted with the zero lower bound, parenthetically, not obvious, the world's central banks think that the zero lower bound is the problem now that they thought it to be then in light of negative interest rates, but we could come back to it. My recollection was that our original exit strategy of QE was that we would shrink our balance sheet back to something like normal. That is, after all, we cut rates to zero first, and then we increase the size of our balance sheet to get more accommodation, that there'd be a certain symmetry to then shrinking the balance sheet first and raising rates. So they have that is certainly not the exit principles that our former colleagues have adopted. Now, I'm not sure I really understand why. A cynic, of which I am not, a cynic would say that in some sense, one of the signaling mechanisms of QE was we're buying assets as central bankers and you should too. And the signaling could work in the opposite regard. We're selling assets and we sure hope you don't follow us. So a cynic would have that as a supposition as to why sort of normalizing the balance sheet first is no longer considered prudent. I don't really know the reasons for it. I think that there is a certain symmetry to it. I think that there is a certain view that most central bankers that are incumbents, unlike has-beens like us, that are awfully worried about this first rate rise. That they, one substitute to that, which again is an imperfect substitute if you believe what I do, which is interest rates and QE are cousins, but they're not identical twins, that it would be prudent to signal that the exit regime has begun, not by any sort of fire sale, but by announcing the time that upon which we would be shrinking the balance sheet. And it turns out the assets that the Federal Reserve has, treasuries and high-quality mortgage-backed securities, are the assets that the world's financial markets are dying to hold on to, that would be a very prudent step and could at least take them out of the situation which they might find themselves now. The situation which I suppose they find themselves now, I'm speculating, is in fact, if they get bad data, they'd say, well, we can't raise rates now. Look at how weak the data is. And if they get good data, then the dollar strengthens and long-term yields increase and asset prices continue to move up, in which case they could argue, well, financial market conditions have just tightened, so we don't have to. So I kind of like your idea of using the balance sheet in a symmetrical basis, and frankly, if asset prices fall, even 10 or 15%, that would take us not back to crisis levels, that would be back to where we were last June. It strikes me asset prices are going to be worth what they're going to be worth, and the sooner that a bunch of authorities somehow think that they can manage that, the better off the real economy would be. And to Josh's paper, the better off that labor would be, too. I think the uncertainty around this is holding back labor markets and labor income, not in a way we can prove, but given the novelty of what we're trying, every reason to believe that the world's big corporations are not investing in real assets, they're investing in financial assets, because on the financial asset side, the government seems to have their back.
Yeah. A couple of things. I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me, but a couple of things that I have in mind there. I do think that unconventional policies, either forward-looking forward guidance or QE, they differ from for standard policies because of the impact they have on the slope, on the curve itself. And that has differential impact on pension funds, life insurers, and so on. So I think this is how I think there's a difference that matters. The other observation I would make is, in my view, we've seen, and it's well known, but we've seen a massive compression of term premiums around the world. to a point where there's a puzzle. You see basically very little compensation for risk across the curve in a world where I would argue risks are pretty high over the next 10 years or 20 years. I mean, we're talking about inflation target maybe being raised. We're talking about liquidity issues on the bond markets. We are talking about a whole set of issues that for some reason you would think would be risk and you would want to be compensated, and yet we don't see that happening. Why is that? I think this is, I mean, one way to reconcile that is the massive size of balance sheets around the world is maintaining those term premium compressed beyond imagination. But at some point, you might wonder what's going to happen. So if you start to raise rates first, if those remain compressed, you won't get the normalization across the curve that you would expect to see, and that's going to, at some point, I think, raise questions about what do we do next. So that leads you to think about a sequential approach given the communication we've heard, where I think raising rates is the first thing, but then eventually questions about what we're doing with the balance sheet might become more relevant or more immediate, in my view.
So 2 points. I think, Kevin, our original plan was not to start selling before we raised rates, but it was to allow the natural runoff of the balance sheet. So there were like 3 stages: allow the natural runoff, then raise rates, then sell. And what's changed is the natural runoff has been postponed till after the increase in rates. So it's not quite as radical a change as you suggested. And I think there's a decent reason for that. I mean, we can discuss and differ on it, but there is a desire to get the federal funds rate up, in part to have space to lower it if bad things happen. Because you might plan on, obviously you wouldn't raise the rate unless you thought the economy was on solid footing and things would progress naturally, but we know we live in an uncertain world in which bad things can happen. Now, if you're selling off that portfolio, the Fed funds rate is still at 0 or 10 basis points or whatever, right? Now, something bad happens, not anything you did, not anything that might be external to the United States, a deep recession in Asia, for example. In order to stimulate the U.S. economy and insulate it from those bad influences, you would need to resume purchasing securities. That would be very difficult, and there are lots of people out there that would, both in the political and the economic sphere, that would resist it. So I think you do need, before you run down your portfolio, you need to get some space to guard against things you don't anticipate. And so it makes sense to me.
Andy? The mic's coming.
I'll be briefer than I was originally planning, since it's 12:30.
Reading the papers for this conference.
And just to come back to a point that Don made that connects actually to the session you had with Larry Summers a few months ago. So let's suppose that QE at the zero bound has crucial political elements to it, that it has real income distributional consequences. That could be an argument that would strengthen the case that Larry Summers made. There really isn't any fundamental reason why you couldn't delegate that responsibility to the Treasury, that they would do purchases and sales of longer-term Treasury securities and MBS. Or alternatively, you could change the Federal Reserve Act and say, if the Federal Reserve is constrained by the zero bound and it needs to do large-scale asset purchases, that in doing so, it should consider the income inequality. I don't think over time that the public broadly is going to be willing to accept the argument that Don made, which is to say, it's just not part of our mandate. Well, I think then in that case, the mandate probably needs to change.
You think the mandate should be changed to make inequality part of their
I think in the
remit?
In the decisions.
Unelected independent policymakers have responsibility for income distribution.
Okay, so we're just recognizing.
We forgot the part where he wants the Federal Open Market Committee to be popularly elected.
No, the point here is that if we agree, and I think the papers this morning, I thought, made a fairly strong case that there are some implications of QE at the zero bound for income inequality. Those are not trivial.
Right.
Okay, then I think there's only 2 solutions. One of them is move that responsibility to the Treasury so that the Secretary of the Treasury works with the President of the United States and reports to Congress and makes political decisions, as they do on many other things. or leave it with the Fed and adjust the mandate at the zero bound. But anyway, maybe there's a third option, but it seems to me that this is, again, just tying back to the issues, that, the kind of issues that Larry Summers raised, which I think are very closely connected to today's discussion.
Just so people know, this is you're talking about Larry Summers talking about the relationship between Treasury debt management and the Federal Reserve, where the Federal Reserve was taking duration out of the market and the Treasury was putting back in, and Larry suggested that was somewhere between idiocy and lunacy, in the usual diplomatic fashion of Larry Summers. Do any of the authors want to weigh in here? Please, Josh.
I'll try to be quick. I mean, I'll say, so in the short term, I'm clearly an extreme pessimist on the, if the Fed had pulled back fiscal policy, I just don't think they would have stepped in. I do totally agree that over the long run, we need to rebalance how we approach macro stabilization and give a bigger role for fiscal policy. I think we have trained a generation of policymakers that the Fed's control over short-term interest rates is all you need and everyone else can just rely on them, and I think that's a huge problem. And then just one other quick thing. It is true that if you look at sort of asset markets right now, they look a lot healthier, I'd argue, than, say, the labor market and other parts of the real economy. Part of that, I think, is still just a function of how early we are in the economic recovery, not in time. It's been a long time, 2000. But just if you look across economic recoveries, early recovery see a big increase in the profit share, and you see that. Corporate profitability is off the charts. And it's only in 2014 that increase in the profit share in the non-financial corporate sector has actually started to moderate, and the labor share is clawing back. And so, you know, I hate to sound like an optimist here, but give it a little time. I think we actually will, if we allow the recovery to continue as it's going, assuming the first quarter data is a blip, hopefully, we actually will see some of that clawback. And so part of that is the recovery is really early in a broader sense, not just time sense.
But to that point, I think this is also a reason why I think there's been an impact of QE on asset prices. But I think you're right. I mean, this recovery has been unusually weak it's in line with post-financial crisis type recoveries. And yet the S&P 60%, the S&P has not only recovered the whole, it's 60% above the pre-recession peak. 60%. And we have so that's what we've the way I think about it is we've made massive progress on the financial cycle side ahead of the economic cycle, and that begs questions as to what's next after. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, we are early in the stage of the economic recovery. I think we've made quite a bit more progress on the financial recovery. I think that could be evidence of QE having an impact on that side, not on the real side, but on the financial side. And I think it begs questions about what's next in the other phase of that economic recovery. There might be less financial performance to be expected as a result.
Kevin?
So the one entity, so I agree with a lot of what Josh said. I think the one entity that has in some sense in front of them as we speak in 2015, this choice between investing in financial assets and real assets are corporate CEOs. That is the S&P 500. With massive cash flows that have profit margins that may well have peaked. And so they can sort of capture in their own decision-making matrix whether these two assets are equally attractive. I think, again, if you look at the data over the last 7 years, what you find is they find buying their own shares back quite attractive as opposed to investing in long-lived assets, property, plant, and equipment, which is illiquid, where they're not sure about the global economy, where they're worried about aggregate global demand. So they keep showing a preference. As we speak today, shareholder buybacks are running at about $1 trillion run rate in 2015, a record. M&A, some of which might be strategic, some of which we might call quite rudely financial engineering, is running well above any recent trend. So I'd be sharing the idea that if we just wait, that labor's going to get their fair share. But it looks to me as though financial chiefs and CEOs and boards have sort of figured out this as well. And they are willing to support their own financial assets, debt financed at very low levels, because in some sense there may or may not be a central bank put. But the world is trying to get their share prices to be higher versus the uncertainty of investing in long-lived assets that could match with long-term gains in employment and have productivity that booms over time. So if I look at them as the illustration of the conundrum we're in, I'm not overly optimistic that labor incomes are going to meet capital on the factory floor and we're going to have this surge because, again, it seems to me, as a final thought, we seem to be favoring financial assets over real assets. As a matter of public policy, without any bad intent, but by effect.
Well, that's depressing. So let me make two advertisements before we end. One is that this afternoon in this room at 3 o'clock, Raj Chetty of Harvard is going to be here to talk about his latest work on mobility and inequality, which will be live cast as this was. And then I can't remember when in November or October, I think, we're going to do an event that raises some of the issues that Susan mentioned about the what is happening to the long-term interest rate and why is it down and whether we should expect it to go up or are we in some long-term trend?
October 30th.
October 30th. I knew if I give you enough clues. I guess I failed on the most important one. But with that, please join me in thanking our paper presenters, the respondents, and the panel.